Justin Kaufman here for the download, 720 WGN with until 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. Very excited to be back on the air for a full ride. Of course, the White Sox today played a day game, lost to the Indians, but that means that we got smooth sailing of talk show bliss all the way through the night, starting with us going into Patty and Nick all the way through. Also, we'll be paying attention to the rain as it starts to hit through. I realize this is an extension. This is the end of Alberto. I was reading that just a second ago, that the Alberto, the sub-storm, I don't even know what that means, but sub-storm that hit Florida. This is the tail end hitting Chicago tonight. So hurricane-like in the sense that it's wet. But we do need to watch out because there are reports that there could be some flash flooding and the like. And we'll pay attention to that tonight with Rob Martier and the crew here at the WGN Newsroom. We got a great show lined up. First, we'll start with the Daily Line as we do every Wednesday night. Heather Sharone and A.D. Quigg will be here to talk about a Springfield budget. What? Not yet. Still a couple hours to go, but it looks as if the leaders of at least the Senate have been behind closed doors working on a bipartisan budget. Look at that. Be done by the end of session, which technically ends tomorrow at midnight. Wow. So they do care about deadlines. We'll see. We'll talk about that. We're also talking about, we were kind of talking back and forth with Roe about the situation where Alderman Riley is now calling for more police presence on Chicago's lakefront after the Memorial Day weekend where there were skirmishes and chaos and, of course, the Wilden group of teens. We talked about it last night. That become a Memorial Day tradition to take the train to the Mag Mile area right around our studio and just kind of walk around causing trouble. And some aldermen and some people believe that the way the Chicago police handled that situation is one that brings civil liberties into question. They corralled the kids back into the train, the Red Line train, and express trained them out of the loop. I've never heard of that, but I have to ask. I mean, I'm open to the idea that that's a better scenario than, I don't know, arresting the kids for, as Roe called it, mopery, or possibly infringing upon their rights as, you know, by putting them in custody. Because they're not down here buying new Lego sets at the Lego store at the Water Tower place. You know, they're causing trouble. So we'll talk with Heather Sharone and A.D. Quigg about that. Coming up at 7:30, 8 o'clock tonight, my guest at the big table, author Michelle Falkoff. Her book, Questions I Want to Ask You, is out now. She's a YA author here in town. Also, she runs the Department of Communication, she's the Director of Communication Legal Reasoning, the Legal Reasoning Program at Northwestern, the Pritzker Law. We'll talk with her about her. She's kind of got a double life going on in the way that she's an established and successful YA author, and at the same time, she is she's molding the young legal minds at Northwestern. So we'll talk with her at the big table. A great book. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Tracy Swartz is going to join us. Good to have Tracy back. She'll be in studio. Her beat has changed a little bit at the Chicago Tribune. She was doing just reality television and working for the Inc. column. That has changed. She's now talking more about television in general. So we'll talk with her about some of the things that are starting back up here in town. And I think we will get to the Bachelorette? Is it the Bachelorette? We will talk about that. Pete Zimmerman's favorite show. So that's on the docket as well. Also, we're going to talk. I'm really excited about my guest. There's a new film at the Siskel Center, and we're going to talk about this. It's a new film called Chosen. I'm pulling it up as we speak. It's a documentary that looks at the Poor Clare nuns. This is a long-standing religious order of anonymous nuns who have really removed themselves from society. They're all over the world. 800 years old. There's one in Rockford that she spent some time. She gave a camera to a young nun who had begun, who had just joined. And she documented the whole experience of what it's like behind closed doors. at the Poor Clare Nuns Monastery in Rockford, Illinois. The film is at the Siskel Center. It's running through tomorrow night. There's going to be a Q&A with Abby Reese, who is the filmmaker who gave us the film. That's very interesting. So it's called Chosen, Custody of Eyes. Poor Clares, a religious order of nuns that shut themselves off from society so they can pray for society. Focus. That's coming up at 9:30. And tonight, Greg Flam's back. You got some junk, some memorabilia, collectibles. I think we should just do the whole swap meet from my office. Pete and I are moving. This whole building is moving. This is our final day in the Trib Tower. There are a lot of things that we have, little tchotchkes, things where I go, I don't want to throw that out. That could be worth something. A lot of things that Greg can take. He could just take. I'll just let him in there for an hour and come out and be like, oh, you cleaned our office. Thank you. You took all the tchotchkes. There's some stuff left over from when Gary Meyer used to sit in that office. When he was on WGN, he sat in the office that Pete and I have, which has seen better days. But
I was thinking about this earlier, kind of reflecting on my time here, which hasn't been very long, you know, a couple of years. And we have this back office on this first floor, and then adjacent to that office is a closet.
Right, like a locked closet.
But when I first started, that was the office they gave me.
Yeah, that's right.
Because Gary didn't like other people in his office, I guess, so his producer had to be in the closet.
I forgot about that. They had said to me, they're like, you know, Mr. Kaufman, you can have this whole office. Your minion, Zimmerman, yeah. He can sit under the stairwell.
Yeah, I was in a closet for like a week, and then finally, we were talking to each other.
There's plenty of room here.
I appreciate that. But for the last 3 years, you've allowed me to come into an office as opposed to sitting in a closet.
Right, just don't look me in the eye. Right. Totally forgot about that. That's the only memory we have. That was more memories of the Trib Tower. Well, that's all we and Pete and I have. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break, come back, and do the carryout. So stay with us. It's The Download, 720 WGN. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. As we speak, the lawmakers in Springfield have started debate on a new budget. Wait, let me back that up. A budget, it's an agreement on how much money the state can spend in any given year. I know, it's an old world term. The Senate leaders in both parties have worked behind the scenes and out of sight to compromise to get a spending plan approved, and it looks like it will pass the Senate tonight or tomorrow. Right now, we're looking at social service cuts and some pension payouts and revenue from the famed Madigan income tax hike. The House could take up the budget and pass it tomorrow before the session deadline, which is midnight. This could make the governor and his challenger both look good and bad at the same time, just in time for the billionaires to just pay more money for new ads to claim victory with hard hats and Harley jackets. No word on whether or not this is a done deal, though. We'll update you throughout the show, but wow, actually, honoring the end of the May deadline? What have you done with my dysfunctional government? Could you keep it there for a while? Wow. Although there are still about 29 hours to go, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. A lot could change. Summit City Council are questioning police tactics over Memorial Day weekend when dealing with the Buck Wildin by groups of teens invading the Mag Mile. This was a huge deal last weekend. We talked about it last night. But the issue at hand is not how the police handled the crowds. It's how they corralled the teens to the train stations and forced them on CTA trains that ran express to the south side. I mean, kids got a free ride. But it does seem weird that cops force kids to ride the rails literally out of town. I don't know. But you know what? It's also kind of fun. It's the red line as crime prevention. Wow. Huh. I guess I don't mind it. I get the civil liberties part of it, but I also get that these kids were not just looking at hoodies at Topshop, right? Maybe getting a Wow Bow. Just a nice ginger tea. No, they were wildin'. Wildin'. I love that term. Wildin'. Seems like a really lazy new word. Those kids are wild. And you know what? They were just, they were wildin'. I don't know. Seems dumb. Cook County Commissioner Bridget Gaynor is once again under investigation. The commissioner and her family have racked up a ton of parking tickets over the last couple of years and then paid for them. That's it. That's the story. She got tickets, and then she paid for them. Dun, dun, dun! Gaynor's been rumored to be interested in a run for mayor, and in that time, she's been mulling it. She's been investigated for also being absent at board meetings and now getting too many parking tickets. The cynic in me wants to know if this is just roll-up-the-sleeves, nose-to-the-grindstone reporting, or if possibly they're working off tips. Anonymous tips from anonymous tipsters with nine fingers. Hmm? I don't know. It just sounds weird. So she gets a lot of tickets. I don't know. Maybe that means she'd get the scofflaw vote. Like my old college roommate. He'd totally vote for her.
Oh, man. She gets tickets, too? That's crazy. I'm going to vote for her tomorrow.
So I wouldn't count on them showing up at the polls, Bridget. In weather, heavy rain expected tonight as the remnants of Alberto hit town. And with that, flooding in the Chicago area will pay attention to it. Then it's supposed to get to up to 90 plus tomorrow. Come on. So you know that flood water is going to be all warm and sticky. Oof. Ugh. Gross. In sports, the White Sox lost the final game of the set against the Indians, getting blown out 9-1. They were swept out of Cleveland. Not a good showing by the Sox in this series. Ronaldo Lopez didn't pitch well today at all. But it was six innings of Kluber, one of the best in baseball. But the Indians, they're the cream of the AL Central, and this series was to gauge where we were. A gauge may be broken. The Cubs continue to roll with two big wins over the Pirates. They look to sweep tonight in Pittsburgh. Also, will this be the game where the Buccos go ahead and plunk? I did this before. It's not pluck, it's plunk. Anthony Rizzo, did they plunk him yet? We don't know. I'd plunk him. They didn't do it yesterday, and he hit a home run and a double. Changed the course of the game. He's so close to the plate. Update on Yu Darvish. MRI reveals no structural damage, so that's good. Just shelve him till August. Act like he's a trade deadline acquisition, right? Also, Carl Edwards Jr., no relation to the fast food place, on the 10-day DL with arm trouble. NBA, you know, mock drafts have the Bulls taking Michael Porter Jr. with their pick out of Missouri. The phenom had back surgery, missed his freshman year, then came out into the NBA draft. You can do that? Anyway, dude's kind of the best option in the NBA draft because of his health concerns. He might be the best available for when the Bulls draft. That's what I mean. So the Bulls will probably skip him and go with a Kukoc type player instead. Or you know what? They'll probably take him because he seems like that's what the front office loves. Mysterious offseason surgeries. And we're really into that. Well, he's great. I mean, he's got 62 hairline fractures, but when healthy, the NBA finals start tomorrow. Boring. Let's talk more about mock drafts. Speaking of mock drafts, the offseason football speculators have taken over cable TV, and I saw ESPN do a graphic that suggested what new teams will be fighting for a playoff spot, and it did not include the Bears. But then they suggested teams that would be in the mix for the top pick in the draft, and they did not include the Bears. How about that? So we're right in the middle. Solid C+. The rebuild is complete. All right. NHL news, Vegas Knights tonight, Washington Capitals, game two of the Stanley Cup final. And finally tonight, Alderman Proko Joe Moreno wants to bring a citywide shared scooter program to town. The bike share is working, so why not electric scooter share? I love it. Your monthly membership would give you access to the scooter, possibly a helmet, and of course, homemade cutoff jeans and handlebar mustache wax. And not the Daisy Duke kind of cutoff jean shorts. We're talking long leg cutoffs. Classic hipster right there. That's the only way you could ride the scooter is with the hipster leg. It's carry out from May 30th, 2018. One more day till June, or as I like to call it, popsicle season. All popsicles, $5. They're artisanal. Deal with it. All right, coming up, A.D. Quigg and Heather Sharone will join us from the Daily Line. We'll talk about all things politics, what's happening in Springfield right now. Also talk about CTU versus CPS. And, of course, Wildin. It's Download 720 WGN. Stay with us.
Doing well, getting ready for the big move, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you wilding on Michigan Avenue after the show with me and you?
Yeah, why not?
Go up and down?
Well, let's do it.
You'll see what's up with the Lego store, maybe hit the Top Shop.
You know, I'm an American girl guy, American doll girl, yeah, sure. Thing, whatever. You know, whatever. Yeah, whatever it is.
I think I know what you mean.
Eventually, I've got to take my 6-year-old daughter there, so
right.
I guess I better figure it out.
Yes. Are you all packed up? You ready to rock?
You know, it's funny because the way this has worked is we've got these big envelopes with our names on them, packing labels, so on and so forth. I don't have a drawer or keep anything here, so I just toss that packet right. Yeah.
If you want, I'll just go around randomly and put your sticker on stuff down here so it just shows up over there. With
you know, that might be fun.
Yeah.
That could be fun. Just leave it in the lobby.
let's see if we can put it on stuff out in the lobby or at the Argo T.
You know what? That's a great idea.
Just put like one of the bottles, which should put your name and see if you can.
All of a sudden, they take off the big, you know, swatch of marble. You know, the Voltaire saying, "How'd this end up over here?"
It's Rob Martier. It says for Rob Martier.
That's right.
All right. That's right. It's time for the Daily Line here on the download. 720 WGN, thedailyline.net covers everything from the city politics to the county politics to, of course, state politics. They join us every Wednesday. Heather Sharon, who is the managing editor, is on the line. And A.D. Quigg, one of the reporters in studio tonight. A.D., Heather, thanks for being here. There we go.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So why don't we start with you, Heather? Why don't we start with the news that I guess is breaking, even though it's kind of a little bit chaotic and confusing. Both the House and the Senate are in session as we speak. One that's talking about a budget, the other talking about the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment. Talk about what's happening in Springfield.
Well, we think there's a deal for a budget, which is very different than where we've been at the end of May for the last 2 years, and it doesn't include any tax hikes, which I guess is good news because the last one did. And it does include about $53 million for upgrades at the Quincy Veterans Home, which is where those 13 people died from bacteria Legionnaires' disease in the water. So we still haven't had a vote yet because, as you said, the Illinois House is debating whether to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. And in the Senate, I believe the last I checked, they were talking about a gun control measure, which I believe has just moved forward.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So it has to go through the Senate, and then the House would vote on something tomorrow when we talk about the budget. The ERA, the ratifying of that, the Equal Rights Amendment would be just through the House. The Senate already did that months ago.
Correct.
If the budget gets through the Senate, which there have been reports that the Senate is coming back tomorrow, so it may not even be brought up tonight. But this idea that it would have to move pretty quick to the House for it to beat the deadline, which is tomorrow at midnight.
Right. So we expect the House to vote tonight. We expected a vote earlier tonight, but the debate on the Equal Rights Amendment has pushed everything back. They're in what is candidly known as unlimited debate, which means anybody can get up and talk. And we've seen some very emotional testimony about what the adoption of the Equal Rights Amendment would mean to various members, both for and against.
Hmm. All right. Well, that of course, we're paying attention to that, and we'll keep you updated on what happens because really the big news, AD, will be tomorrow as we see the governor has cleared his schedule. And it's from all you know, indication, it does seem that the governor is okay with this, that he is okay with the Republican part of this bipartisan agreement for a budget.
Right. There was some debate as to whether he would hold this up again as a sign of, I'm going to keep fighting Mike Madigan because we need a budget and we need to get rid of this income tax and I need to fight. But it seems like it's on the safer side for him to say, we've got a budget. I'm no longer a no budget governor, especially heading into 2018.
Yeah. Heather, why don't we shift gears as we, you know, we're looking at, of course, you know, obviously education plays a big role in what's happening with the budget and higher education is being talked about. But really the headline stolen today by a fight between the union, Chicago Teachers Union, and the Chicago Public Schools over competing commercials. Is that what this is about? As they look to set the record straight through 30-second ads?
That's right. So earlier this month, a group called Progress Chicago made, which is funded by several people who have donated to Mayor Rahm Emanuel, put together an ad that features CPS CEO Janice Jackson talking about what great stuff is happening at Chicago schools. And while it never mentions the mayor, saying that things are going well in the schools is sort of an implicit way of saying, hey, why would we get rid of this great mayor who's doing all of this great stuff?
Right.
the Chicago Teachers Union, not a big fan of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, so they put together a 30-second rebuttal ad that notes that Janice Jackson is his fifth CEO, and one of them is currently in federal prison for ripping off Chicago taxpayers. So the union made it clear that they don't want to see Rahm Emanuel elected in 2019, and they don't think it's appropriate for him to be campaigning on success in Chicago schools when he says the union says it's very clear that the record is at best mixed.
And there's some questions, and Lori Lightfoot has brought this up and wants an investigation into whether or not this group Progress Chicago, which is a fundraising arm,
right,
essentially for the mayor's re-election campaign, should be using the CPS CEO in any sort of advertising.
Right. She says it's overtly political for her to be used this way, even though there's no direct mention of 2019 and Mayor Emanuel. And this is interesting because I was wondering if Progress Chicago would stick to schools issues. And last week, they put out a statement congratulating the mayor on passing the Obama Presidential Center through city council. So early on, they've only been around for a month, and they're already kind of striking out and talking about all these other issues that will be big in 2019.
So is that what they are? I mean, Progress Chicago is a not-for-profit that raises money for the mayor? I mean, is that how it works?
Well, they're an issues group, so they are allowed to spend at this point pretty much whatever they want, and they don't necessarily have to reveal a lot of details about where their money is coming from. However,
like a local super PAC, right?
Huh. Right. So we do know, however, that they are funded in part by Michael Sachs, who is Rahm Emanuel's biggest donor, and, you know, is somebody who clearly wants to see the mayor reelected in 2019. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel faced a lot of questions back in 2015 about the closures of schools and sort of how he was handling the school district. And, you know, there was the teacher strike and all of those questions. It's clear that Progress Chicago sees the issue of education as sort of something that the mayor has to deal with to get to reelection. And of course, we saw him today announce that the city would create free full day preschool, right, for 4-year-olds over the next 4 years.
Yeah. And we can expect to see CTU driving back that issue. This week, we also had reports coming out about the impact of the 2013 school closings on these kids and how detrimental it was, setting these kids back by 2 or 3 months on their achievement. And we're going to see CTU hitting on that issue. And also, we have a series of corrupt CEOs and also members of the Chicago Board of Education.
So, yeah, so essentially a referendum on the mayor and how he has dealt with education this season as mayor. Heather Sharon and A.D. Quigg are here. It's the Daily Line, dailyline.net. They join us every Wednesday on the download. Let's take a break and then come back, talk summer violence. And downtown Alderman wants more police on the lakefront. We'll talk about these Wilden groups and the way that the police have corralled them to train stations. And also, what I don't think the police gets enough credit for, what I thought to be a more positive story in Memorial Day weekend. We'll have more of that coming up here, so stay with us. To download 720 WGN, I'm Justin Kaufman. A.D. Quigg and Heather Sharon are with us from the Daily Line. They join us every Wednesday night here on 720 WGN to talk all things state, county, and Chicago politics. Let's talk Chicago this summer. Of course, summer violence is on everybody's mind. Memorial Day weekend, 7 dead, 32 shot, which I sound so cynical when I say this, but that sounds like a pretty good number, you know, and I know that sounds terrible coming out of anyone's mouth that 32 people were shot. But just a couple weeks before, I think the number was 90, 95. Usually around a Memorial Day weekend, you get numbers that are much higher. Am I looking at this the wrong way to say the Chicago Police Department should get a positive story for effectively controlling summer violence on a big summer weekend?
I mean, anyone would say someone getting shot is bad, someone being killed is bad. But any news is good news, I guess. And it's such a hard battle because nice summer weather brings out a lot more people than usual, and a lot more people means more potential for conflict.
Heather?
Well, I was just going to say that Eddie Johnson was asked that question, and he basically said, look, I'll celebrate when there are, you know, are zero shootings and zero murders. But there's no doubt that it was a different level of gun violence. And I think that that's something that city officials saw and breathed a sigh of relief, because last year, you know, the New York Times sent a whole reporting team to chronicle violence over Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, there's nothing that gets the mayor's goat more than national attention on violence and that sort of thing.
Now, that being said, the Memorial Day weekend also brought out some bad headlines for this area, particularly around where we're broadcasting the Mag Mile, the lakefront. Alderman Riley today stepped out and said he wants more police presence on the lakefront and the beaches because there was a lot of skirmishes and fights. Of course, we've been talking about the wild and the teens that come downtown and how you control these mass crowds of 100-plus kids that are down here causing trouble. There's a lot that's going into that today. This story is coming up. What is your take on how the police are dealing with what Heather has become somewhat of a Memorial Day tradition, these kids that come down and it, I guess a summer tradition in the fact that it seems to happen year after year?
That's right. And, you know, these groups, police say, are sort of gathering via social media. You know, somebody texts somebody else, somebody posts something else on Snapchat. And then all of a sudden you've got 100, kids sort of outside Water Tower, which is what happened at one point this weekend. Some aldermen have been less than complimentary about how they've been handling that, because instead of, you know, arresting people who are committing acts of vandalism or otherwise defying police orders, they've been sort of shuttling these groups onto train lines and getting them out of downtown. They sent a bunch of Red Line trains express from Chicago to 35th to sort of diffuse the problem. The Tribune had a very good story that detailed sort of what happened when the group got off of the train. It sort of moved the problem, you know, to the south side. And there's really a question of, you know, if that's the right way to handle it. Are you, you know, sort of solving a problem, or are you just sort of pushing it elsewhere in the city, perhaps where there are fewer eyes, fewer cameras, less attention from news media types like us, right?
Yeah, and I give them a little bit of credit. I have to say it's a creative way to deal with a problem that usually ends with mass arrests for charges that don't stick and things that have we've talked about other things. So for the police being creative in the way of working with the CTA to move these crowds, to corral these crowds into express trains, there is something to be said about that.
Yeah, and it's hard to pinpoint who the troublemaker is when it's a group of 100 people and you only have a certain number of cops, and those cops can make a certain number of arrests, which also involves processing. And, you know, taking one cop off the street while they're handling an arrest means you have fewer eyes on these other big crowds. More cops is something that every alderman calls for around the summer. It's an annual tradition from Alderman Brendan Riley. He is very concerned about lakefront Mag Mile safety, but if you Google Brendan Riley crime, you will find every summer he says, we need more cops, we need more cops, we need more cops.
Right.
And it's the same for a lot of Northside aldermen who are saying, we're seeing a rise in crime. We're seeing teenagers who, quote, aren't from here coming around our neighborhoods, and they shouldn't be here.
And I don't know what the numbers are, but just from anecdotally walking up and down Michigan Avenue at lunchtime or dinner time before doing the show here, there is police presence, unlike anywhere else in the city. You'll have two stationed police officers at Ontario and Ohio. There definitely is a police presence down here to protect this area because it's so heavy in tourism and merchant.
Yeah, and we've already seen the ACLU and other criminal justice groups saying we shouldn't pre-criminalize these teenage kids just for being in groups and being downtown. And this kind of goes to a broader a broader discussion we're having right now.
Carjacking stuff,
but also how police are utilized around the city and what the perception of crime is, and also illustrates this kind of tightrope that the mayor has to walk, saying, you know, I'm tough on crime, but I'm also cognizant that we shouldn't be criminalizing these young black youth, and we should also be focusing on economic development for some of these kids who, you know, there was a woman in the Chicago Tribune article that Heather referred to saying these kids have nothing else to do, and that's why they're down here creating problems.
And it's not new. This is something that we remember, and I may even predate both of you in the sense that I think it was the U.S. Supreme Court that came down and said that the anti-loitering plan that Mayor Daley had back in the 90s, where he had essentially said if anyone got together with more than three people on a stoop, that the police had the right to kick them off. This was in an effort to stop groups of kids getting together, whether it be in the neighborhood or downtown. So this is something the city of Chicago has dealt with for decades.
Right. And, you know, it's a very fine line that officers have to walk because, and city officials, because if they don't, you know, stop a sort of a gathering like this from sort of turning into something more serious where people get hurt and injured, it has the potential to, you know, turn into a major incident. And, you know, like I said before, the last thing any city official wants is headlines about how dangerous Chicago was, especially downtown, you know, on a major holiday weekend. And we saw the mayor sort of focus on that earlier this spring when he announced that there would be additional patrols assigned to the Riverwalk, which right. has become sort of, you know, a whole new sort of gathering place. But there was a very serious stabbing incident last summer that, you know, threatened as, and I think it was either Brendan Riley or Brian Hopkins, alderman, said, you know, we can't let this Riverwalk get a reputation for being somewhere you don't want to be after dark, because right. that will undo all of the sort of economic development efforts that the city has really, you know, paid a lot of money to set up.
Very interesting. Heather Sharone and AD Quigg from The Daily Line. You can find their work at thedailyline.net, covering all things city, county, and state politics. Also, the podcast is back starting Friday. AD, you've got an interview with?
Soon-to-be assessor Fritz Kagi, talking about assessments.
There you go.
They're the best.
If you're going to, I always say this to anyone, aspiring podcasters out there, if you're going to have a premiere episode, it yep. should be about assessments.
Yep, property taxes.
That's right. That's what I always say. Heather, AD, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Dustin.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with it till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Tracy Swartz is going to join us. She is an entertainment writer for the Chicago Tribune. We're going to talk about some of the shows that have Chicago connections that are coming back in the realm of television. Also, we're going to talk about a new documentary, which is at the Gene Siskel Center, running through tomorrow. It's called Chosen, Custody of the Eyes, and it looks at the Rockford Monastery of the Poor Clares, the nuns, the religious order that has shut themselves off from society so that they can pray for society. There's too much chaos in the world, so they live an anonymous life, and there are orders all over the world, but there's one in Rockford, Illinois. And Abby Reese, the filmmaker, she was able to get access because they're very private. And there was one nun who was, I guess, a nun in training, if you will. And she did video diaries and showed the world. And Abby was able to put together this film that they're showing at the Gene Siskel Center. So we'll talk about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Very excited to have that conversation. Well, the new book, Questions I Want to Ask You, is a YA mystery following the main character, Pac, who just turned 18 years old. And as he gets ready for life after high school, and his blossoming relationship with his girlfriend, Maddie, he's delivered a letter from his mother. The only problem, his mother is dead. It's a mystery about family secrets and unpacking the past, which in this case is keeping the main character from his future. This is Chicago author Michelle Falkoff's third novel. She's also the director of the Communication Legal Reasoning Program at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. And if that's not enough, she teaches fiction on the side at the University of Chicago. The book, like I said, Questions I Want to Ask You, is got a launch party coming up tomorrow night in Andersonville at Women and Children First at 7 o'clock. And Michelle will be part of the Lit Fest, which is coming up next weekend here, of course, in Printer's Row. Michelle, thanks so much for being here. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get into this book. I don't spend too much time in my life around the YA genre. Why write a book about an 18-year-old and have a mystery surrounding a character this young?
I have such a long list of answers for that.
We got an hour, so we're good. No, we're good. Spread out.
One of the things that I really love is that the young adult category is sort of, it's not genre specific, right? So I started out writing literary fiction, and it's very constrained in a lot of ways. That writing for adults kind of means that you have to categorize yourself in this really aggressive way very early on. And I always enjoyed writing things that kind of slipped between different kinds of genres.
Oh,
right?
Interesting, yeah.
YA is still pretty fluid. I mean, I worry that might change someday, but right now, what's what's really nice is that in a YA novel, you can do just about anything. So I can write something that has, you know, what I hope is the literary sensibility that I enjoy, but that also has conventions of mystery and all of those things, and then can explore issues from the teenage point of view, which I find really fascinating.
What is it about it that fascinates you? I mean, you're sitting across from me. You're not a teenager.
No.
You look like one, but you're not. But, I mean, what is it about that experience?
Not accurate.
What is it about that experience that fascinates you?
I think there's a lot of things about it, but the main thing is that I have such a clear recollection of how urgent everything was at that age, right? Everything seems like the most massive thing that could possibly happen. And a lot of the things that happen are, right? I mean, you know, kids deal with all sorts of different types of issues, but they deal with them in a really specific way, right? They're very personal to them, and they're part of their kind of maturation process in a way that they're not for adults, right? Adults are sort of supposed to be equipped to handle
right.
trauma, drama, problems, romance, whatever it is. Teenagers are supposed to be figuring it out. And so if you throw stuff at them, their reactions can be all over the place.
As a writer, I would assume that that makes it easier to be authentic. You can make mistakes in how they respond. Their emotions can be out of whack because it's a coming of age and the
Absolutely.
Fact that they're in the maturation project.
And I think that it's a lie to think that grown-ups know how to do stuff, right? I mean, we don't know anything. We just front like we know things, and we're supposed to do that. We're supposed to put on that face for the world. As kids, we didn't have to do that, and they certainly don't have the same obligations that we did. At the same time, there are tremendous pressures placed on kids. There are so many things that they have to deal with, and they're sort of moving into that adult phase and wanting to be there maybe faster than they're ready, willing to take on things that are kind of more aggressive than they have the resources to handle on their own, but unwilling to ask for help. Like, so YA for me is this amazing space where kids are taking over their own lives, and they still kind of need help, but they don't want it.
That's so interesting, especially thinking about reading this book. Let's talk about the main character, Pack, who, as I mean, 18-year-old, who's just, I mean, really set at the end of high school, the last day.
Yep.
Life is looking ahead. He's, like I mentioned, his relationship, and he's called. There's a letter for him at the office, and he goes to the office and he grabs this letter. He's anticipating opening it, and it's from his mom. And as I said, I don't want to give away too much, but as you say, and you know, the first big twist,
copy,
it's on the
so,
back.
You know,
is that his mother is dead. He's never knew her. So, talk about this. I mean, as you set this up, where does a story like this come from? This idea of really kind of bringing the twist in and the mystery into a YA novel.
Yeah, the answer to this one is not going to be amazing. I will do what I can, right? I am usually a very sort of idea-driven, practical, you know, like I'll have a concept I want to work with. I am not one of those, like, the characters came fully formed and they magically birthed themselves in my
right,
brain. Like,
right.
I don't really do that. But somehow I came up with this first line. The letter arrived on my 18th birthday, and I didn't use it, right? I mean, it shows up in there somewhere, but
yeah, right.
I had the idea that that was the first line of a book, and I, you know, and then you sort of start to unpack, right? Like, okay, who cares? Why, you know, like, first of all, people don't really get letters anymore, so that's already weird. Why does it matter that the character's 18? Who would be writing a letter at all? Who would be surprising? And you start to kind of think, like, what could get weird about this? And I came up with this idea that it would be, you know, a male character who didn't have a mother who got this letter from someone surprising, but then the question became, okay, what would he do with that? Like,
right.
what would be interesting, and what kind of person would that be interesting to happen to? And it sort of banged into something I've been wanting to explore for a long time, which is all about the drive to leave where you came from. Right. So I was one of those kids, like I was super nerdy. I wanted to like get out of my hometown as fast as possible. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to live in 7,000 cities and, you know, never come home again. And that wasn't the experience of most of the people I grew up with, but I didn't get them and I never really understood it. And I always wanted to explore that territory mm-hmm. a little bit. And so it occurred to me that it would be really interesting to have someone get a letter like this in a situation like this, who was someone who wasn't actually curious about the world, who didn't
yeah.
want to leave, who didn't want things upended, someone who wanted everything to kind of stay the same forever.
Yeah, that's so interesting because there's even a moment where the character doesn't really want to follow his curiosity. He doesn't want to find out about the letter. This is this letter from his mom telling him intimate details he didn't know anything about. You would think right away in a coming-of-age story that this is the beginning of a journey. But it took a little bit of coaxing to even have him bring it up to people that were close to him.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to play with a lot of the different tropes that you expect to see in books like this. So, like, most YA novels sort of culminate in getting the big romance, and they culminate in graduation, and they culminate in prom, and they culminate in leaving. And I wanted to turn all of that on its head. You know, so this is a book where, you know, the girlfriend's already there. The prom and graduation happen in the first few chapters. Right. You know what I mean? Like, right. We're just kind of getting rid of all the big high school experiences and getting ready to stay still, right? Like, getting ready to sort of stay at the gym forever. That's what this kid's right?
That's true.
And I was like, wouldn't it be strange to have to deal with that? Like, to have to, like, how do people learn to be curious?
Well,
that was
a
question
great,
I wanted to
there's
answer.
There's a great line. I think it's from Maddie. It's like, what is your gut telling you? And at a certain point, it seems like the character up to that point had that shut off. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to even look into that. The book is called Questions I Want to Ask You. The author is Michelle Felkoff. She is going to be at Women and Children First Bookstore tomorrow at 7 p.m. for the book launch. She's also going to be involved with a couple of panels and events at the Lit Fest coming up here next weekend in Printers Row. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More with Michelle here at the big table. So stay with us. World champion Michelle Felkoff will also be at the Printers Row Lit Fest. She's my guest tonight at the big table. World champion of something, right?
Sure.
The new book, Questions I Want to Ask You, is out right now. It's a young adult mystery, and it is doing well. And it's also the book launch. The launch party is tomorrow night, Andersonville, at Women and Children First. Starts at 7 o'clock. She'll also be at the Lit Fest. She's also the director of the Communication Legal Reasoning Program at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law. We'll talk about that coming up. Also teaches fiction on the side at University of Chicago. Why not?
Yeah, who needs free time?
I garden on the side and teach fiction at the University of Chicago, so that's good. All right, so let's continue. We were talking right before the break about all of the things you try to avoid when you try to put a novel, a mystery novel, a YA mystery novel on its head. When you want to turn, you want to essentially be ahead of the reader, because a lot of times there is a trope, there is a cliche that it ends at this place, or it ends with the romance, or maybe graduation. Do you have to think about that as a writer? Do you have to think about as you're actually writing the words down and thinking about the way the book comes together, that you need to avoid those tropes, that you're trying to do something that is different?
So this is my lawyerly answer. It depends, right? That's my answer to every question that my students ask me. You have to do a certain amount of planning, and there are lots of conversations amongst writers about the extent to which you kind of plot your books ahead of time, or whether you kind of wing it. They call it plotting versus pantsing, going by the seat of your pants.
Right.
And it's a tough balance, you know, because on the one hand, as a writer, you kind of need to have a sense of where you're going. You don't want the book to be kind of a hot mess where nothing makes sense. But on the other hand, if you're going to make writing interesting for yourself, it's kind of a, you know, voyage of discovery. And so you have to leave things to figure out. And so, you know, I wish I could say that I had come up with a process in these three books, but they've each taken very different approaches.
Well, I would just think, because I've had mystery writers on, and we've talked about the twist and how important it is. And there is, in a way, there is a format to the mystery. There is almost like they talk about with screenplays. The idea that by a certain page, a character has to be introduced, or a twist has to happen. And then
Chekhov's gun.
Right, exactly. Is that the same with mystery novels? Do you have to pay attention to, I have to introduce that the mother is dead by a certain point in this book to make the mystery unfold?
I mean, I probably should, but I tend not to think about it that way. You know, one of the things that I like to do is to kind of play with the lack of rules that the category affords me. And so, you know, by not having it be a formal mystery, I don't have to follow all the conventions of mystery novels. I can, you know, hybridize it in some way and say that it's a literary mystery, or it's a whatever, you know, just to kind of release myself from the obligation to follow some of those rules. Now, that may or may not be successful depending on how the readers feel about it, right? I feel the mystery writer's obligation to plant clues, to do a certain amount of misdirection, to kind of make sure that the reading experience is satisfying, or is as satisfying as I can make it. But it's almost impossible to really do that from the writer's side in a weird way, because you can't be as surprised by your own stuff.
Right.
You know, so I have people who I sort of count on to try to help me.
Well, I would wonder, you know, writing in the YA genre and giving yourself that opportunity to almost have a hybrid genre to do YA and mystery at the same time, you can borrow or lean on certain one part of the genre while you know sort
messing
of
with the other.
Discarding the other part, right? It gives you the opportunity, because even when I think about this, the writer or the reader for a YA novel may not necessarily be someone who has read hundreds of mystery novels, right?
Absolutely.
They may have a different, but they still needs to be true to the idea of what a mystery can do.
Absolutely. And it needs to give them that sort of experience of figuring things out or being misled in a helpful way. I mean, I'm a huge mystery fan, and to me, there are only a few like real cardinal sins that you can commit as a mystery writer, right? Like one is to cheat, you know, which is to have a mystery where it's not possible to figure it out from reading the book, and you just kind of get the ending sprung on you.
Right.
That enrages me. And so I hopefully will never do that, right? But the other is to have a mystery that sort of feels unjustified by what came before it, right? Like to kind of have the clues unfold in a way that just ultimately doesn't make sense. And I try, again, you know, who knows how successful you can be, but I try really hard to make sure that I'm doing the kind of, you know, breadcrumb dropping and misdirection that would lead someone to have a theory of the book that is entirely feasible and inaccurate.
Yeah. And obviously by setting up the story that, the main character turns 18 years old, and you set up that he lives with his dad, and there's no mention of the mother, and then to have this letter pop up right towards the beginning of the book, you do set up a mystery that can go in any direction. He can go on a hunt to find his mom. He can try to figure out the story through piecing together what his dad has told him, which is partially what he does. But there are a lot of different directions. How important is it for a mystery to have those directions, to have multiple avenues to take when you're, you know, early on in the book?
I think it's incredibly helpful. I mean, but it might just be the kind of reader that I am, right? There are people who love the comfort and convention of mysteries that do exactly what you expect a mystery to do. And I feel like the people who want that kind of mystery are the same people who like go to the McDonald's in Paris. Right. They know what they're getting there. Right. And like they know that they're going to feel at home. And that's great. But like I want to eat weird snails and stuff when I go to Paris. So I like strange things to happen. Right. Which means I want room. I want the expectation to be that he gets this letter and he is in his car looking for his mom immediately. And then I want him to stay home for a while because that's weird. That's not what you expect a kid in his position
to
do.
It's so
right?
true that it happens on his birthday. He has a birthday plan with his mm-hmm. girlfriend. He has this whole thing he's been setting up for the first few, you know, chapters.
Yeah.
And he knows that revelation, this letter, is going to ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so true. And that's what I like about it, is it's so true that if that were me in that position, I'd probably be more interested in my girlfriend sitting, we're about to have dinner, than trying to figure out
and,
about
I mean,
my long lost
mom. His dad's not home. That's a big deal in high school, right?
Not home. That's right. Michelle Felkoff's in studio. She's the author of her new book, Questions I Want to Ask You. It's her third novel, her YA novel. She's got a launch party tomorrow at Women and Children First in Andersonville. It starts at 7:00. She's also going to be involved with the Printers Row Lit Fest. We'll talk about that, as well as her job as Director of Communication and Legal Reasoning Program, the Legal Reasoning Program at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law. That'll be coming up here as we continue our conversation at the big table. So stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download 720 WGN. It's interesting news about the Equal Rights Amendment ratified by the House. It was already approved by the Senate, and it does not need a signature from the governor. So it is now ratified in the state of Illinois. I forget, Rob knows the what state we are and when it comes to the number of. I think we're like somewhere in the 20s that has done that. So here we go. We are now a state that has ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. That was put forth in the 70s. There we go. Big political hotbed. Now we can focus on the budget, which is happening in the Senate on the other side. It's the Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest at the big table tonight is author Michelle Felkoff. She is the author of Questions I Want to Ask You, which is a young adult mystery. It's her third novel. She's also the director of the Communication and Legal Reasoning Program at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. It also teaches fiction on the side at the University of Chicago. There's a launch party tomorrow night in Andersonville at Women and Children First. It's 7:00. Check that out. And also she will be at LitFest, Printers Row LitFest, coming up next weekend right here in Printers Row, the South Side, near South Side. All right, let's. I have to ask. I don't know much about the communication and legal reasoning program. I keep saying that as if it's something that we all know,
right?
And I know nothing about it. What is that? I looked it up and I understand it, but
sure.
But talk about this because it's really for first year, first semester law students.
First year, so for it's sure. It's the first year sequence of analysis, writing, and research courses for first year law students. All the schools have different names for it. The school that I taught at before called it Legal Analysis, Writing, and Research. Some schools call it the Lawyering Program. Some schools just call it Legal Writing. But the most important part's kind of the analytical piece, and so we don't like to leave that out, the reasoning part that we talk about.
So this is really about the 101 of lawyering.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the course that kind of pulls together all the doctrine that students are learning in a bunch of different classes and helps them learn how to think through legal problems and then articulate potential solutions for people.
Well, the obvious question for you as a writer, how do those worlds meet? I mean, do they inform each other? Does the work that you've done in the legal arenas, has that helped you to be a better fiction writer?
Absolutely, and vice versa. The big picture way that I would put it is to say that my view is that all writing is persuasive in some way, right? So when I'm teaching law students about persuasion, I'm teaching them how their writing and their communication skills can help them get better deal terms for their clients or convince judges that their clients are innocent or whatever it is that they're hoping to kind of achieve from the perspective of an attorney. And it's easy to see it in that context, right? Because we always think about lawyers as persuading people. But this book that you're holding in your hand, basically, is about an 18-year-old boy who's, you know, mother sort of disappeared under weird circumstances. I am not going to say my actual age, but like I'm not an 18-year-old boy by any stretch, right? But I need to convince you to believe that for the scope of for the amount of time that you're reading that book, if that book's going to be successful at all. So I'm constantly on a mission to persuade people of different things.
You don't think about that as when you think of anyone who is an author, anyone who's a writer. You don't think about persuasion or trying to convince readers if this story or this character is authentic or plausible. But that is a huge part. That's what it is, right?
It's everything
when you talk about the connection. So there is this fine line or this straight line connecting legal writing and fiction writing.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's also a really important role, you know, to flip it around, right? I like to flip things on their heads. To think about the role of narrative in the law. Right? Because a way to persuade people effectively and to make stories convincing or make the law convincing is to turn it into a story, right? And to make it personal, to humanize it, to make it specific. There's a ton of room for being able to empathize and articulate and talk about human stories when you talk about the law. When we talk about things in random abstractions, it's really easy to make bad decisions.
We
can see it in the political world.
Are the best lawyers the ones that can do that?
Absolutely.
That can spin a yarn like that?
Yeah, and not in a... I don't mean it in a cynical way at all.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Lawyers who can take a particular problem that they're trying to solve and make it a human problem, and find a way to come up with a human solution that takes into account the views of all the parties involved in some way, those are people who are likely to get what they want out of a negotiation, out of a litigation, out of whatever it is that they're trying to do.
It's so interesting, too, because my mind automatically flashes to the surge of podcasts that have been around mysteries and real-life crime. I think of Serial and others that kind of brought
Serial
that.
I love Serial so much.
But it's about, we always talk about it being this way in which you can tell a better story than the case actually was told. You know, in that case in Serial, at least the first season, it was all about the producers and the journalists telling this story in a way that we connected with and almost in a way that the lawyers in that case couldn't. So, I mean, there is definitely, you can see how if a lawyer could do what Serial could do, they would have a better chance of convincing people of their case.
Absolutely. And they had the added advantage of being journalists, right? So not only were they dealing with, you know, expert lawyers who could evaluate a case and experts in narrative who could tell the story in the best way possible, but also experts and communicating that type of thing to people who don't necessarily understand it well and grabbing the public's attention, right?
Yeah.
Like that, I sort of think of that as what journalists do in a lot of ways. Like you guys become experts in a topic very quickly and you learn how to draw people in and get them talking about what's interesting and important to them. And they were able to take all those threads and make Serial a show about the nature of narrative, the nature of law, and the nature of journalism. I was fascinated by it.
as a when you're talking about or you're teaching young law students who come in and you're talking about analyzing, you're talking about, you know, how to write legalese. I don't know how what you say.
Not
about
legalese. Not We're legalese. Trying to teach them not to write legalese. Yes.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
But do you find them, I think about it with young journalists, you find them inspired by the work that they have consumed? Meaning young journalists will come in and they're like, oh, I want to be Serial. I want to be those guys. So this is how I'm going to talk. This is how I'm going to act. And then you have to sort of like train them, say, you can't be that until you understand the facts of the situation. We have that problem in journalism big time. It causes a lot of stories to be told wrong, to be frank. In your case, is that the same with lawyers? Do they come in and say, oh, I know lawyers from this. I know I want to be a rock star. I feel like I can do this. And they kind of skip over the important parts of
it's similar,
aware.
But it's a little bit different, right? So the problem that we have is that we don't actually have these sort of rock star lawyers whose writing they get to see, right? We have instead a lot of public misconception about what lawyers do via like public entertainment, which
right.
I love, but you know, my students will tell you that if you start me talking about how to get away with murder, it's going to get ugly, right? Because that show, I adore it, and it does a huge disservice to the legal profession in sort of the best possible way, right? Everything about it is wrong, and it's amazing. The students come in, and they have these preconceived notions of what lawyers do. Then they start reading cases, and there are not a lot of judges who are beautiful, elegant, clear legal writers, which is what we want our students to be. And so they're reading a lot of bad case law, or not the law itself, but they're reading a lot of bad language, right? And they're reading a lot of legalese, which we don't want. They're reading basically lawyers writing things that are designed in a way to keep information away from the public, which is not what cases are designed to do. They're meant to educate, right? And so when you think about the public education function of case law, we need to move back to a conception of people being able to actually understand how to read cases, right?
That's where the legalese needs to go.
That's where it needs to go. And that's what we're trying to teach the students. But they're seeing a lot of negative examples as they go. And then you combine that with most of them were really good writers when they were undergrads doing a very different type of work than what we're training them to do. And we're like hypercritical. We come in and we're trying to teach them a new way to think and a new way to articulate themselves that doesn't involve a lot of beautiful language or elegant phrasing or sort of narrative complexity. We're trying to get them to take really hard stuff and make it sound easy.
Right.
That's a hard job,
it's
right?
Everywhere, right.
Yeah, and they're super resistant, and it takes a lot of training, but they get amazing. And so it's a real pleasure to be able to work with them over the course of a year, but it kind of, you need the year, right? You need to be able to show them
That's
over
why,
time what they can do.
Michelle Falkoff's in studio. She is the author of Questions I Want to Ask You. She's also the director of the Communication and Legal Reasoning Program at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. She also teaches fiction on the side at the University of Chicago.
Fun.
You know, for you to have this be your third novel and to see that the YA genre, young adult genre, has really dominated. I mean,
it's been incredible.
Think about, I mean, from even the five plus years that you have been working in this, you have seen more and more more and more attention to the genre, whether that be to turn shows into or turn books into shows or movies but also just the rabid readership, the consuming of these products. I mean, how has it changed in the time that you started your first novel to putting this out today?
It's just getting more attention and more attention, and people keep thinking it's going to slow down. And I'm sure that's eventually going to be true, but there is such incredible work happening in this space. And I say this not to denigrate the work that's happening in literary fiction or other genres, but what I've found is that YA moves really fast, and it's not afraid of engaging with the culture as it is right now. And so for someone to sort of see something happening in the world and want to grapple with it as a complicated issue, it's only a few years before you can sort of pull it together, write a book, get that book out there.
Right.
And that's a relatively short time in the grand scheme of turnaround for novels, right? And the example that I love to talk about is Angie Thomas's The Hate U Give, which has been at the top or near the top of the New York Times, you know, young adult bestseller list for like a year. That book is unbelievably good on so many levels, and we don't have time to talk about it, but I recommend that like everyone in the world read it. It's amazing. And it's an incredibly smart, thoughtful book that is taking on, you know, really, really difficult topics about race and about people's relationships with the police and their relationships to their community. And like, the fact that that book has been like the top of our cultural conversation in this space for this long is beautiful.
You know, I'm always interested in when writers come in, and a lot of times you'll get your name, for your name will become synonymous with a certain genre. Do you find yourself at a certain point wanting to do something different? And will you be able to, in the sense that you get a name and you get a recognition, you get a brand, everybody wants to check out the new Michelle Falcoff joint, you know, like this, do you see a career in which you can jump across and do different genres and different pieces of fiction outside of the genre that you started in?
It's a good question. It's a hard question, right? Because on the one hand, yeah, your publisher wants you to be a brand. But you know, the people have to want you to be a brand too, right? Like, I am not at the level of whatever, you know, to be sort of pigeonholed into anything at this point. But at the same time, you know, I know that my publisher likes that the books that I've written have a similar feel and are kind of approaching a similar audience in a similar way. There are certainly things I want to play with, right? These books have all been firmly grounded in realism, and I like reading things that are a little less tethered, and so I wouldn't mind playing with that. I write short stories for adults too. You know, someday maybe I would want to write for adults again, although right now all of my ideas are kind of in this space, and so I'm happy to hang out here for as long as readers will have me.
Because you could think of some of the great children's books, and the authors of those books are not children. I prefaced my question that way. But do you see a point where you age out, where you say, you know what, the new generation, let's say in 15, 20 years, the new generation of kids who are reading YA novels, they're not the same as the kids that are reading it now.
But that's what makes it fun, right? I mean, that's what makes it not boring, is that the kids are going to change, the world is going to change, and you have to adapt, you know, like change or die, right? And so, you know, if everything were the same forever, it would be so boring to keep writing, right? I mean, I love the idea that everything is going to be different and I'm going to have to learn new stuff and it will keep me from stagnating and, you know, not
well, this book just came out, but I'm already looking forward to the next one. Questions I want to ask you is the new book. The author, of course, Michelle Falcoff, she is going to be at Women and Children First Bookstore tomorrow night, 7 o'clock for the book launch. And she's also going to be at the Lit Fest coming up here in Printers World Lit Fest next weekend. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you being my guest at the big table.
Thank you so much for having me.
Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. We're at the halfway point. Conversation there with Michelle Falcoff. Going to be at Lit Fest. Going to be at Women and Children First tomorrow night. Great to talk about both young adult genres, Chicago writing, and avoiding legalese. Who knew? Coming up 9 o'clock, Tracy Swartz going to be here from the Chicago Tribune, entertainment reporter. We're going to talk about a couple of shows. Pete Zimmerman's favorite show, The Bachelor Master Chef. Yeah, it's a whole new thing. It's Master Bachelor. It's a chef dating show. No, we're going to talk about Bachelorette, Master Chef, Black Ink Crew. We had Van Jones in here. Is Van Jones right? Yeah. The tattoo artist came in. I think that's not right. I have to take a look.
It's CNN guy is Van Jones.
No, it's not Van Jones. It's Van Smith. No, that's a safety for Clemson. Anyway, he was good. I really enjoyed who we talked to. I just have to get his... I guess it's just Van.
It's all you need.
Yeah, if you... It's a lot of Van. Van Johnson. Nailed it. It took me a while, but I got it.
When you're watching, like, The Bachelorette, as I did on Monday, the 50 guys come out, and, you know, it just says their first name. And there's a couple of guys from Chicago, and Tracy's written about them. But then, you know, I'm, like, trying to find them on Facebook. So I'm trying to find out their last name. They don't say their last name on the show, but I'm like, Steve Bachelorette.
Steve,
you know?
Bachelorette Steve.
And I was like, what am I doing? Why do I care what Joe, grocery guy from Chicago, where does he really hang out?
Just trying to friend him? And
I don't know what I was doing.
What are you trying to do? That's hilarious. I need to find this guy on Facebook. We need to be friends. Gary, the grocery guy, needs to be my friend. That's funny. Tracy, coming up here right after the news. Then we're going to talk with the filmmaker for the new film, Chosen, Custody of the Eyes, a new documentary that looks at the Rockford Monastery of the Poor Clares, a religious order of nuns that has essentially shut themselves off from society so they can pray for society. That's what they do. They live in anonymity, and they have a there's an order in Rockford. And a young blogger, it's a great film, a young blogger had decided that she wanted to go into this, that she had decided she wanted to dedicate her life to this order, an order that's been around for 800 years. And she joined. And at the same time, Abby Reese, the filmmaker, she was doing a journalism project about them and telling their story, and they trusted her, and she built a relationship. And for this film, she gave her a video camera, and she documented her life, a life, a very private life. This particular order of nuns, they don't like the outside world. They like I said, they live in anonymity on purpose. They don't want attention. And they let Abby in with the camera, and this young, I guess you say nun in training, did a bunch of video diary type pieces and showed, and she was able to put this thing together, and it is now a hit of the festivals, and it's at the Gene Siskel Center, running through tomorrow, I believe. She's got a discussion tomorrow night with the audience. Fascinating. It's called Chosen, Custody of the Eyes. It's at the Gene Siskel Center now.
The Chosen tells me that you just can't join up.
Right. You have to be chosen.
Because it doesn't sound too bad.
You know, the idea of wanting to get... It sounds like it would be somewhat a good time to enlist. When you're watching the documentary and they're like, we shut ourselves off from society because we need to focus on praying. I'm like,
yeah,
it'd be nice to focus on one thing. You know, I'll pray. I'll pray for everybody.
A little less pictures of Trump and Kim Kardashian.
Yeah, right. Don't have to do any of that.
Don't have to deal with any of that.
No CNN, no Anderson Cooper. You're just praying. Something to that. I'll take it. All right, all that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Then Greg Flamm joins us for the swap meet, so stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, swap meet. Greg Flamm is here at DuPage Picker. What do you got? What's at home right now that you're like, man, I've got the coolest stuff, and I just don't know what it's worth? And they go ahead and call in, and then Greg says it's worth $1 million, and life will never be the same. 312-981-7200, or you can win a pizza. One of the two. So we got a lot to talk about. The last time we had Tracy Swartz on the program, we were talking about, I think it was Bachelor in Paradise, which was one of the shows that didn't do so well. It was around that summertime last year, and then the Blackhawks started back up, and now with the White Sox, no Friday nights, a reality check segment was put on hold. But Tracy Swartz is back in studio tonight, television writer for the Chicago Tribune, to talk about some big shows that have some Chicago connections. Tracy, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I guess right off the bat, we'll just go right to what Pete Zimmerman wants to talk about, and that's The Bachelorette. He, of course, is the Download's resident expert when it comes to all things Bachelor. The Bachelorette is back. The premiere was this week, Monday.
Right.
Chicago is represented, obviously, because Pete's been searching them up on Facebook.
Just a little bit. We had a couple of guys. Each season we get a couple guys from the Chicago area. This one had more guys, actually, a little bit from downstate. But we had Grocer Joe.
That's what you were talking about, grocer guy.
Yes, who was very popular on Twitter with the fans. Not so popular with Becca. He was cut on Monday.
Oh! Oh, no.
Now you don't have to watch the rest of the season.
That was such a short-lived segment we just had. Tracy Swartz, thanks for being here. Oh, is that it? Is that it on the Chicago?
No.
There's so, other guys.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me preface this by saying that Joe did so well on this premiere that they are considering, there's a rumor that he's going to be in Bachelor in Paradise this summer, which is very rare for people who get cut the first night. because they want to usually have a cast of people who stay around till towards the end, because then you've created a relationship with these people. Right. And we didn't see much of Joe except an intro video that was shot here in Chicago. Riverwalk on his, you know, cell phone in the loop, and at his grocery store in, drumroll please, Hegewisch.
Okay, so
the Hegewisch neighborhood.
Oh, so he's a grocer from the Hegewisch neighborhood.
He's from, I believe he's from Melrose Park, but he has a grocery store.
Oh, all right. Hegewisch. I like that. Maybe we can get him in here, Grocer Joe.
Maybe. but Bachelor in Paradise is supposed to be starting soon, filming in Mexico. And unless there's a big problem like there was last summer where they had to shut production down. Yeah. He might be gone for a little while.
You know, that was such an interesting moment for this whole, the whole franchise, the Bachelor franchise. They had an issue of, I guess it was allegations of sexual misconduct on the set of Bachelor in Paradise. It stopped it. The ABC did an investigation, said that they had cleared it all up, and they went back at it. How has that experience changed, if at all, the franchise? Do more people kind of look askew at this idea of this dating show where 75 people come in and one person gets to choose and all the things that go along with that?
It definitely hasn't stopped dating shows, because the dating shows have gotten stupider. And it's, you're marrying strangers and getting engaged to strangers and that kind of thing. But I saw that they put some new, like, a new set of rules on the, so now there's drink limits where you can't just drink, you know, any, as much as you want to. You can only drink, you know, one or two drinks an hour. So hopefully,
are you serious? That's a rule, like,
yes,
on the,
they count.
Scroll it?
They count. They have a bartender who counts the drinks to make sure you are not overserved.
That's on the show? Like, yes. They'll have a little counter?
It's not a counter that you can see, but the bartender is supposedly keeping track. At least that's what they implemented last season when they restarted production.
I just feel, I try my best, Tracy, to be up on all the different segments that we do on this show. I really do. I'll read the books. I'll watch the films. I try to really immerse myself. I don't know what it is, but I cannot get into The Bachelor. I know that there are millions of people that can, and I know that that's a huge show. Pete Zimmerman has no problem turning that thing on. But I don't know what it is. My eyes gloss over within the first 5 minutes. I just can't do it. I'll watch a marathon of The Kardashians, but I can't get into The Bachelor series.
Huh. Well, I don't know what to tell you, except it's actually, of all the dating shows, it's not the worst.
What am I missing? What is it that I should be looking at? What can I use to be a hook to try and get in this season?
Well, if you didn't watch The Bachelor last season, season 22, it was race car driver Ari. And then you really missed out on some big TV, because basically the reason Becca is the bachelorette now is because Ari proposed to her. They were engaged. And then sometime after that proposal, he changed his mind. And he went and decided to go with the runner-up. And
which is the design of that show. I saw all of the headlines. We talked at that time. But isn't the design of that show, who's he going to pick? He might go this way. He might go that way. He might go this way. I mean, I understand the blow up over it, but the format is to encourage that kind of thing.
Right, which is Ari's sort of defense when he's talking about being crucified on Twitter. But what you don't typically see is, I mean, there's a lot of indecision. Who am I going to choose? You know, this and that. But he filmed his breakup with Becca. And it was excruciating. I think it was like 40 minutes long. And it was just this raw, like, she was very surprised out of nowhere. She thought she was going to be doing what they call happy couple visits. When one of these shows, when one of these proposals happen, they have this period of time between the proposal and when the show airs. So the producers let the couple spend time with each other, but not in public. So they go to, a secluded mansion, a retreat. And so this woman, Becca, thought that she was going to spend some quality time with Ari as part of one of these happy couple visits. And she was blindsided with cameras, which are not typically at those visits. And and the breakup. So this is, if you want a hook, it's really just seeing this woman sort of...
on the rebound.
Well, right, rebound from a very public humiliation.
Total humiliation. And the I saw this week that he blames it on editing. That in a profile, Ari came out and said, you know, I've been crucified on Twitter, but really it's the way they edited that together. That's not how it went.
Yeah, he said, so he did this big GQ profile, and he said that he wanted to leave. Part of what was excruciating was it was 40 minutes long, and Becca kept asking Ari to leave, and he just wouldn't leave. And it was like drawing the whole thing out. And he said that what you didn't see was that producers were coaching him and telling him he had to stay, and that, like, oh, like, I think that she's calming down. Now you can take your time to talk to her. And she wasn't calming down, and he just looked like a jerk for not, you know, doing it quickly.
Manipulative. Reality TV producers? That doesn't. No, I don't even know what to say. Tracy Swartz in studio. She is television writer for the Chicago Tribune. When we come back, let's talk about some other shows that are happening right now that have Chicago tie-ins. It's Download. Stay with us. In studio tonight, Tracy Swartz. She is the television writer for the Chicago Tribune, talking about some of these shows that are out right now that are really starting. This is kind of interesting because... gosh, I remember when I date myself to think that TV only started in October and possibly second season in January, February. But the end of May is a big time for television, especially with the streaming networks now, Netflix and others, Incredible or Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt's coming out, I think today or yesterday, one of the two. But there's a lot of TV that comes out for the summertime.
Right. It's mostly reality TV because the scripted shows run, you know, like your school year through May and then pick up back in September, October. So there's a ton of reality TV and a lot of Chicago ties. This week, tonight was the premiere of two shows with some Chicagoans. The first was MasterChef. We've got three local people on the season. There's 43. It starts with 43 and they pare it down to 24 on tonight's episode and then an episode next week.
So MasterChef, to get everybody up to speed, was different than Top Chef.
Yes.
And some of the others. MasterChef is more of like your Bachelor, where there are a ton of people and then they cut it down.
Well, MasterChef is your home cooks. So they have to have different occupations. So the local people, it's a sales manager and a dental student and a fashion model. And they go for the $250,000 prize. That's one of Gordon Ramsay's shows.
Oh, okay.
And we're sort of on a hot streak in Chicago right now because earlier this month, the winner of MasterChef Junior, which is the kids cook, it's 8 to 13-year-olds, was a girl from Pilsen.
Oh, yeah.
So she,
and then Joe Flam won Top Chef.
Top Chef. So if someone, one of these three, wins MasterChef, it'll be a hat trick.
Is it the same concept as MasterChef, same as the like Chopped and the others where they're like, and now we introduce the ingredients. You'll be cooking a dead fish. you also have to incorporate this piece of plastic. Like that kind of thing, like where the judges try to make it crazy.
What episodes of Chopped are you watching? No, it's more like Top Chef, where you have individual challenges, what they call mystery box. So I guess that's maybe
that's
where you
of,
would
yeah.
be cooking your plastic. But they also have team challenges, and this season is new because there are three judges, and they mentor eight contestants each.
All right, sounds like a good show.
So
then, is Kitchen Nightmare still a thing? Sorry to divert, but is that still a thing?
Yeah.
Oh man, that was my favorite show.
That's
this is terrible.
This is when they serve the plastic and the roaches and stuff.
That's my favorite. Gordon Ramsay. Mm. All right, moving on. Black Ink Crew.
Yes.
This is season 27.
Only season 4. It only seems like season 27.
We had Van Johnson was in studio, and I did a big table with him. Such an interesting place and an interesting guy. The show, of course, is not necessarily about tattoos. It's supposed to be about tattoos, but it's about the relationships around and the shop. Well, where does this show come from? I'm fascinated by all of what is Black Ink Crew.
It started in New York, and the New York edition still runs, and this is a spinoff, and it's based in the Nine Mag Tattoo Shop in Pilsen. They're located in the Lacuna Lofts. It's a bunch of artist space and event space down there. And what makes this premiere, so tonight was the premiere, different from the rest is that there was an incident that's shown on the premiere where earlier this year, the star of the show, the guy who owns the place, a guy named Ryan Henry, for whatever reason, he destroyed the tattoo shop. And he
destroyed it? Like he trashed it or he torched it? What do you mean he destroyed it?
He trashed it. He painted over a sign. He took a gun and fired bullets into the wall. Debris was everywhere. It happened like overnight in January, and the cameras weren't rolling or anything. And so this premiere really took a look at the aftermath of that. And in fact, it had a ripple effect because one of the neighboring businesses in that loft space ended up calling the police because there was property damage. And I spoke to the executive producer, and he said that it was really sort of a critical moment for the show, and they shut down production for more than a week so they could take a look at some of their safety and security practices, because they show a lot of fights on this show. It's fist fights, it's you know, loud arguments, and it's wherever they go. I mean, they film a lot, not only in this Pilsen loft, but they, you know, are out and about in the city. So they really took a look at their security measures to see what they can do.
And it's
better.
It's a crew, so it's not just the tattoo artist. There are people around him. Mm-hmm. There's several characters that play out in what is this reality television show, soap opera, that surrounds this chaotic but very artistic and I mean, unbelievable tattoos that are happening. And so does it not take place anymore at Nine Mag? Is it not there because that place was trashed?
So you have to see how...
I don't want to give it away.
Well, you have to see how the season plays out. But basically, Ryan, you know, the owner, is sort of charting his own path separate. And so they were still filming this current season as of last week. So I don't even know if they know how it's going to end up.
And that's on VH1.
That's on VH1. It premiered tonight.
All right. So as I think about it, a couple minutes left here, obviously, you've got the Chicago Fire and Chicago PD and other shows like that. I saw on Twitter not too long ago there's a show called Redline that looks like to be shot here. The Chi on Showtime. Chicago, where are we as a city? I mean, are we getting more work than we ever got before when it comes to television production, or is it pretty much maxed out?
It's about the same. Last year was big for movies. There's a movie coming out, Widows, that's got a lot of high profile people. And then there's another one coming out next year. It's Captive State. It was filmed here. So last year was a lot of movie work, and this is a lot of TV work this year. But a lot of it's the same. It's, you know, the Chicago franchise. Shameless comes back every, you know, 2 weeks each year. The Chi will be back. But the Redline pilot is new, and there's a new series, HBO series from Jordan Peele and J.J. Abrams, Lovecraft Country, that'll be here. It's based on that novel, and so you'll be seeing some new things
as
well.
That's Jordan Peele to come back to Chicago. He had done improv here, and now to come back as an Academy Award winner. Did he win? I think he won, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he sure did. Okay. Tracy, great to see you. Thanks for coming in to update us on Chicago television and what's happening, not just here in Chicago, but with Chicago connections, especially when we talk about Grocer Joe. And do you have any predictions for how The Bachelorette might play out? Do you automatically, after the first episode, go, I know who's going to win?
Well, actually, it sort of played out in the tabloids. There was a woman, I guess, who was on her honeymoon overseas and spotted production and snapped photos of who proposed to Becca. It's not a spoiler. She said that she's engaged, and the photos appeared on TMZ a couple days ago.
Do you already know who won this thing?
I do.
But everybody does if they watch a show. Pete, do you know? You know, have you been paying attention to the paparazzi in London?
I have.
And so you know who's already going to win this thing? That's bogus, man. They blew it. You guys, man. You're on hook, line, and sinker.
I'm sure it won't work out. I mean, if that's a spoiler at all, you know, we were talking last summer, the big there's a lot of reality TV that was being filmed here, and I wanted to give you this update, and I've been wanting since last week. I just covered both spouse house divorces.
They divorced.
Wow. And it got finalized last week. So
not to say that you didn't call it, because you did call it.
Two weddings were filmed in the spouse house, two divorces, although there's one couple that did meet and got engaged and are getting married in July.
Spouse house.
Guess what? They're not bringing that back for a second season. No. So sorry. All you spouse house fans.
Spouse house is now divorce house. Tracy Swartz, Chicago Tribune television writer, joins us for a segment we call Reality Check. Haven't seen you in a while. Great to see you, and look forward to catching up on well, we already know who wins The Bachelorette, but on other shows. Good to see you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Rob. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Greg Flamm joins us at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, for the swap meet. This is where we evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your Chicago junk. 312-981-7200. We find out if it's worth anything. It's always fun. And the best brag gets you a pizza. It's an awesome segment we do every Wednesday night. 312-981-7200. Greg Flamm. I'm just going to send Greg back to my office because we're moving. Tomorrow is the day that all of our stuff gets moved out, and Pete and I have been cleaning out all these tchotchkes. There's some leftover stuff, some GN stuff, some stuff that was there before we started. I'm just going to let Greg in the building and let him take care of it, spend an hour in there tonight, and boom, it's all cleaned up. We're ready to move, so see if that works out. Chosen, Custody of the Eyes, is a new documentary that looks at the Rockford Monastery of the Poor Clares, a religious order of nuns that has shut itself off from society in order to pray for society. The Poor Clares were created 800 years ago and continue to live anonymously in enclaves all around the world. The film follows a young woman who recently joined the Poor Clares in Rockford. The former blogger named Heather was given a camera to record her process. The filmmaker, Abby Reese, gives the woman a camera, and in return, Reese and her audience get an intimate look into the very private world of the cloistered Poor Clares nuns. Abby Reese began this project back in 2005 after compiling a book of stories and photographs about the nuns. The film is wrapping up its run at the Gene Siskel Center on State Street with an audience discussion tomorrow night. Fascinating. But first, filmmaker Abby Reese in studio tonight. Abby, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What a tremendous film. Just it's not lost when watching this documentary that this is something that people just don't see. The cloistered nuns and especially the Poor Clares, they live in this ethos of being private, being anonymous, not telling their story, not drawing attention. Where did your fascination with the Poor Clares come from?
Oh, I think part of it is just, you know, that draw of women who withdraw from the world and don't need to be seen. And my interest in, you know, if they're not part of the public record and we don't hear their voices generally, I don't, you know, before I started this project, didn't know their stories. I thought there's probably a story. There's stories there that I have never heard before. Mm-hmm. And there's perspectives that the rest of us could probably benefit from hearing from. They have perspectives that we don't hear. We don't know.
How do you even approach a story like this, to approach them with a story saying, I want to tell your story, when it's in their ethos to not tell their story?
Yeah, probably naively. I mean, I went over there when I had been really interested in finding a community that would be willing to talk with me. And so I approached a couple in different communities that I visited. And then I learned that this place in Rockford existed. And I was from Chicago, but grew up near this community in Rockford, but didn't know it existed.
Wow.
And so the day that I learned that it was there, I drove right over. And there's several barriers into the space. You ring a doorbell, and there's you have to speak with a nun through an intercom, and they have to grant you access, and then a mother abbess has to agree to meet with you. And so I said, you know, I'm just back from a year living on a ship in Africa, and I'm interested in how community functions in an enclosed space, and particularly religious life, you know, how your lives, what are your motivations?
Right.
What are your lives? They prayed about it, and access just increased over time.
Were they, at the beginning, were they reticent? Were they like, treat you like someone off the street as you were to say, you know what, all the mail that we don't want goes in that bin, put your thing in the bin and we'll talk to you later. Were they reticent to even talk to you?
They were, the Mother Abbey is, the first word that comes to mind, I shouldn't say that. She has a kind of a smart alecky personality. So when I first met her, I was trying to understand exactly how to read her, but she was, you know, they didn't need me there, you know? And so she was being a little, like you're saying, a little reticent with me and sizing me up and asking me why I wanted to do this. And I said, you know, I want to undertake a long-term project conducting oral history interviews and making photographs. I know that you don't actually generally speak, and I know that you seek hiddenness from the world so that you can pray for the rest of us, but you know, would you consider talking to me? And I also secondarily said, I'm also interested in meeting a young woman who's considering this life. So, you know, somebody who's looking back, I could see, you know, this is a woman who, these are women who, when they're considering it, are actually kind of in a, I wouldn't say vulnerable position, but they're in a real, their ideas are fluctuating, you know,
right.
It's not a fixed way of being. And so it was very generous that they let me.
And I want to ask about Heather and the film. But even before we get there, when you talk about the oral history and the photographs, what did you expect to get? I mean, as someone who was, you know, as you just mentioned, living on a ship in Africa and wanting to and dedicating your life to telling these stories, what do you think you were going to be able to get once you start working in, because they are closed off, they are private. Talk about the process of trying to suss these stories out.
Yeah, I will say that I got way more honesty, way more vulnerability and sincerity than I ever anticipated. I got way more humor. People, when they learn how long I've been working with the nuns, I have to say, you know, I wouldn't be doing this still if it was a dour experience, you
right,
know.
Right.
It's been tremendous, you know. I've gained friendships through it, and really, it's been incredible.
The film is called Chosen: Custody of the Eyes. The documentary is on is last day coming up here at the Gene Siskel Center on State Street. The audience discussion is tomorrow night with filmmaker Abby Reese, who's in studio tonight. We'll do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, and I want to talk about Heather. Heather is the name of the nun who, I guess, say nun in training.
Yeah.
who if it does such a tremendous job in this documentary of being able to give us access and tell stories through video diaries that are woven into this film. Abby Reese in studio, we're talking about the film Chosen: Custody of the Eyes. We'll continue that conversation. Stay with us. There you go, and all eyes on the House tomorrow. State budget in place. Looks like we might actually beat the deadline, which, of course, is May 31st. That's not new. That's always the deadline, and it's new that they hit it. So we'll see if it actually happens in the House tomorrow. Thanks for that update. More coming up at 10 o'clock with Rob Martyr. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's a download here on 720 WGN. And we are talking about the new documentary, Chosen: Custody of the Eyes. It looks at the Rockford Monastery of the Poor Clares, religious order of nuns that have shut themselves off from society in order to pray for society. They've been around for 800 years. They live in anonymity, and they try to not tell their story, which is why this documentary is fascinating, from filmmaker Abby Reese, who gets them to tell their story and open up and do it in such a way. The way that this film is presented is what I think why it works, is that you find a nun in training, if you will, and by the name of Heather, and that's what we're calling her, who has a history in blogging. She was a blogger who made this transition and said, I want to join the monastery. I want to be a nun. I'm a Poor Clare's nun. And in doing so, is able to tell the story because she has the skills to tell the story because she has done it in her past.
Totally. So I interviewed her for 6 years, from 2005 to 2011, while she was, discerning religious life. And so in her case, it was finishing college, trying to get a job, dealing with the recession in 2009, trying to get a graphic design job, but still wanting to become a nun, you know? And finally, 2011 actually does it, joins this community that I had just written a book about. That book wasn't actually published until 2014. But I've been working with that same community since 2005. So I already had access with the same community that she entered. And that, you know, there's so many things that this project wouldn't have happened if you know, and it never would have occurred to me with the other nuns in the monastery to lend one of them a video camera, but with her it works.
She has the skills to be able to tell the story because a lot of it is from her vantage point, either video diary entries where she's on camera talking about her experience, or she's the one who's shooting and she's the what she sees and how she sees it. And there is a fly on the wall feeling to this documentary, and why I really, really enjoyed it is this idea that it's something that nobody sees. This is when you are in this monastery in Rockford. This isn't, you can't YouTube that, you can't be like Monastery Rockford and get a bunch of different. I mean, this is from her vantage point. This is what she is seeing. You are seeing something, even if it's not a correctly framed shot, if you will. You're seeing something that nobody's ever seen.
It's true. So like, once a woman joins, even when her family comes to visit her, they're separated by metal bars. What one of the young relatives of one of the nuns calls the Jesus cage. She calls the monastery the Jesus cage because the family of the nuns can't even enter the monastery.
Wow.
But like you're saying, you know, none of us would actually be able to see this, but the nuns did actually let me in to make photographs and to make video. And I did all of that. And I thought it would be so much better if it's from her perspective, and lend her video camera, not knowing what it would come back with, kind of like as an experiment, because she had been a visual artist, but she'd been a painter, never working with a moving image. And so the first, you know, I got permission from her superiors, pitched her the idea, and she was excited, which, you know, I was excited about, because she had been kind of, you know, not totally excited about the interviews I was doing with her. She always seemed to be holding back a little bit when I was holding a mic, you know, up to her face. And but with the video camera, you know, she could go into these hidden spaces in the monastery, and she had in her head all of these years of questions I'd been asking her, you know. And so she goes in there and shares these video diaries.
She answers them, yeah.
She answers them just so sincerely and openly and eloquently, which, you know, before she did these diaries, I'm like, well, maybe she's just not eloquent. Maybe she's just a visual person. And I started looking at the video diaries and I thought, oh my goodness. Well, she is an amazing cinematographer as well.
When, I guess the question that it all comes down to is, what were you surprised by? I mean, being a part of immersing yourself and getting photographs and stories and putting microphones in the faces of the nuns before, you had an understanding already of the monastery, but putting the film together, what surprised you? What was it about the story that you didn't know already?
Oh, so much. I mean, there's so much that I didn't totally understand. I mean, one of the things was I made a couple requests for the video footage, but I didn't know if they were actually going to film one another's faces or their own faces.
Yeah.
Because when I first made photographs of them, they asked me to blur their faces. So when I gave them the video cameras, I didn't know if we would actually see their faces. And these video diaries are up close. Her face fully, you know, fills the frame. And again, totally surprised by how eloquent she is. I think also I had been interviewing them for, you know, 10 years before I did a mindfulness class here in Chicago. And at that point, I finally understood what contemplative living was. All these interviews and, like, you know, trying to grasp it with my head, you know, right, of what they were describing.
This idea of shutting themselves off to focus on praying, to focus on being contemplative.
Yeah, and minute by minute, like, experiencing what, you know, what is in this particular moment, like living in this moment. I didn't understand viscerally, and I wouldn't have been able to make this film reflective of that way.
The Order is 800 years old. I mean, it's tremendously religious.
It's medieval.
It's medieval. And I think about, there has been, as you just mentioned, mindfulness. There has been a trend towards more mindfulness in our society. You had more and more people doing silent retreats and mindfulness classes, as you mentioned. There is something to be said about that. But then there's something to dedicate your life. And these nuns at different Poor Clare's orders around the world, I mean, this is their entire lives. They have spent in contemplative prayer. It just kind of blows your mind to think about all we know about the trends of mindfulness, but to completely immerse yourself 100% of your life into prayer, into being contemplative. It's hard to fathom.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, so they have something called, I call it like a prayer hotline, and they would probably consider it like a lifeline, you know, that people can call in every day and ask for prayers, and they pray for the rest of us. I didn't realize, I was in a very serious car accident, so it was 2009, 4 years into meeting with them, and I broke my back in the car accident. I was on my way to the monastery, and I learned after I got out of the hospital that they had been praying for me that morning on my way there. They've been praying for me every day since I first visited the monastery, which is, it's incredible. And I think for the people who I've talked to who seek prayers from the nuns, there's this incredible resilience that it gives, knowing that there are women in the world who we don't see, we don't hear generally, but who are there just praying for us, you know?
Abby Reese is the filmmaker of the film Chosen, Custody of the Eyes. The documentary is at the Gene Siskel Center on State Street. There's an audience discussion tomorrow night that starts at 7 o'clock. Am I right on that? Close?
So the film starts at 8. It's an hour and 47 minutes.
So
and
after
then,
that. Yep. Yeah. So it all starts at 8 o'clock, and the audience discussion is afterwards at the Gene Siskel Center on State Street. The film, again, Chosen, Custody of the Eyes, which looks at the Rockford Monastery of the Poor Clare's Nuns, a religious order of nuns that have shut themselves off from society so they can pray for society. Filmmaker Abby Reese in studio tonight. Abby, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks again for making the film.
Thanks so much, Justin.
Coming up, Greg Flamm in the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Already getting some texts, calls coming in. People want to find out what they got, what it's worth, but they also want the best brag of the night. Because the best brag is going to get you a pizza. Always good. That documentary was so interesting. The one thing that I thought was so great about that documentary is that it's very amateur, meaning it is video diaries. She gave video cameras to the nun in training, and she did all the stuff. So it's shaky, the moment where she's trying different cool visual techniques. She puts the camera up while they're composting a bunch of flowers, or she brings the camera up to the window in the dark to look outside, and you can hear how quiet it is, but you can also hear the road in the distance. And like she said, the actual video diary stuff where their faces are is really close up on her face where she's talking to the camera, just like you would on see it on YouTube and other places. But there's also this way that she'll turn the camera on the other nuns, and there'll be different ages. Or there's this great shot where one of the older nuns is holding the camera. She's got it almost VHS style, where she's got her eye in the eyepiece and she's holding it. And it just shows that they're communicating and interacting with each other in a way that we're just not allowed to see. And I just thought that was kind of interesting from an artistic, creative production element, the idea of seeing something that hasn't been seen before. Interesting. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Greg Flam's going to join us. We'll do a little swap meet. Got a lot of good stuff, man. 312-981-7200. Stuff already coming in tonight. We'll get to it in just a moment. We've got a WKQX record album from 1977.
WKQX?
Yeah. That's what it says, WKQX hometown album.
Yeah, that was Q101.
I know, but why would it be 1977? I'm trying to look at it right now. Bert Sherwood, general manager. Yeah. Anyway, looks cool. 612 says, I prefer contemplative as opposed to contemplative. Okay. You should have been in our production meeting.
We were working a lot on
trying to figure out the best way to say that word when I said it a couple times because it's contemplative. Contemplative. Well, whatever.
Sorry. I was actually impressed that you brought it out, actually.
I know. I went with the flow. This was in the last segment. I opened myself up. I opened myself up, and it took 612 about 5 minutes to be like, I'm going to make fun. I'm going to roast this guy. I'm going to roast him. All right. So we are moving as we speak right now. This is very exciting. We are moving studios.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a ton of really weird, dumb stuff, right? There's some stuff that we've collected over the years. Not just dumb, but some interesting stuff, right?
Yeah, there's some
good
stuff.
And I want to see if Greg wants any of it, because Patty is cleaning out her office. Mm-hmm. Bill and Wendy as well down here. Steve Bertrand. So there's just a lot of stuff. And it's not just GN stuff. It's stuff you've accrued over the years. So we brought some of this stuff in, and I want to see if when we start here in a couple minutes, I want to see what he thinks. I've got you're going to like this one. I've got a T-shirt. That is Bob Fioretti for state senator, 5th District.
All right.
When he was running for state senator. This was before Cook County Board President, mm-hmm. So it would have been the last, like, 2014.
Two elections ago.
Yeah, so, you know, it's got a little schmutz on the bottom of it. I think it was used to clean up some spilled Argo tea or something like that. Sure. Also have, my brother was big into T-shirts, and he was making a bunch of T-shirts, and he has one that was a bunch of T-shirts that he named Chi-Town is Guy-Town, and it was really targeting the gay community.
No.
And he had done a bunch of these, and he was working it out. He was like, this is gonna take off.
Yeah.
The gay community, Chi-Town is Guy-Town. And it did not take off. And I have one of the prototypes. So there's that. I also have a DVD from De Beer, the famed De Beer,
mm-hmm.
presenting 16-inch softball, A Game for Everyone, a quick video tour of softball's most exciting game.
Yeah.
Unopened, in the package.
That's how Greg wants it.
Yep. Bob Campbell, who is an inductee of the 16-inch Softball Hall of Fame, the guy who hosts it. In this video, it opens with a fast-paced, exciting montage, how to play the game and summary of the rules, history of the game, and a rich and growing tradition.
I'm saying that is probably the most valuable piece.
Yep.
So far.
I start the bidding at $500. And then there's an old style pizza plate and pizza cutter.
Mm-hmm.
Old style cozy. There's a lot of stuff. Blackhawk stuff. So we got a lot of stuff for Greg to go through. He's coming up here, and we will have him in just a second. 312-981-7200. If you want to queue up, get your stuff ready to go. We're going to come back here, get Greg in studio, and get to it. It's Download. Stay with us. It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Very excited that Greg Flam is in the building. There's a bad accident there on 55, but he is here. Ready to take your questions, your calls, your comments, all of the above. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Greg Flam, of course, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. He is ready. He is here. He's getting his stuff set up. So why don't we get started?
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's
it's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam, he's here.
Saved by the Bell.
Saved by the Bell. 312-981-7200. You can get Greg, of course, at Two-Page Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. I just wanted to show you this De Beer DVD, Greg.
Oh, nice.
Take a look. 16-inch softball, a game for everyone. A quick video tour of softball's most exciting game. Still in the package.
Trunk wrap, yeah. Nice.
What do you think? 200? 500?
I have to look at it more, but I would... 500. I would start more conservatively at 25, maybe. But I got to look at some more. Maybe it is worth
it. Maybe it's worth something. All right. Well, I was telling everybody today that we have completely started the move out of our office.
Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of collectibles, memorabilia, junk.
I'd love to get my paws on it.
There's a lot of stuff back there. We'll let you get to it. This is now we're in the full swing of the summer. This segment, yeah. Of course, sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market. Yep. What do we got? I mean, this is the prime time for swap meeting.
It is. Lots of good stuff out there. Tomorrow looks like a great day. So if you're into garage selling, tomorrow should be a good day the whole weekend. But I found a couple posters and compliments of my friend Jim at Wolf's. He's let me use these for the segment.
Look at that thing.
But there's a... whoops.
There you go.
There's a Vote for Sox and Addison poster when they were threatening to move in the mid-80s.
That's great.
That's really awesome. Rare, and it's already got bids like over $100.
That's when they were threatening to move Comiskey.
Right, to Addison.
Vote for Sox in Addison.
Yep.
Punch 294.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's so great.
And it's really cool and really rare, so he should do well with that. And then I have Richard J. Daley, mayor election poster, good for Chicago.
Look at that.
And
do you have a date on that, or is it just...
It
says Mayor Good for Chicago's got a picture.
I think
old man
it's late 60s, honestly.
It says 68, February, in fact. 1968 yep. poster. You get a pizza.
Yep.
You get a pizza, Greg. That's amazing. Look at that thing.
You would think this would be worth quite a bit, but obviously election posters, they made a lot of them. The Sox one, you know, wasn't an every year thing, so that is why that's more rare. Plus, it's got the 80s Sox logo, you know, on it, so... it's you know, it makes it really rare. But
Louise.
even the Daily poster, there weren't any on eBay of any of his election posters.
Really?
But so, you know,
that's
we'll see
my
what
favorite
happens.
Right there. That's my favorite.
Yeah, it's a
that's
great a, look.
I think Sue might be able. Let's start with Sue. She's going to get us started here. But I mean, she's going to have a. I think she can even up the Daily poster. Sue, what do you want to brag about, Sue?
What I want to brag about is I have a campaign button from the mayoral election in 1983, when Bernard Epton ran against Harold Washington.
Wow.
And what does it say? Before it's too late?
No, it says Epton for mayor.
That's it? Boring.
Yeah. Wow.
I think it was Epton, wasn't it? Epton, one of the guys who was, like, he had all the slogans that were like, before it's too late, and these weird and veiled but not veiled racist slogans because they're running against a black guy.
Yeah, the two I see, it just says, our next mayor, Bernard Epton, and then the other one just says, Epton Majerzyk was his running mate. Yeah. Those are only two, and they're about $9, 10, you know, 15.
Ah. That's bogus.
You're right.
It should be $100.
Always the bearer of bad news here.
Oh, I think so. I'd just like to say I knew him. I worked at the law firm where he was a lawyer.
Okay.
And he was actually a very nice man. He was a World War II veteran, highly decorated. And I don't think he was a racist like came out to be portrayed.
Yeah, well,
it's politics.
Yeah. I was going to say it's politics, and they were going for certain, and I'm not even sure that it was Epton himself who was the guy, but there were a lot of different, you know, even the Democrats at that point were angry about what was happening. But thanks, Sue. Thanks for the history lesson. Yep. We appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. There we go. All right, so Sue starts us off. Bernie Epton. Can't go wrong with a Bernie Epton button from 1983.
Yep.
All right, we've got 708's got a signed Gale Sayers card and football. We've seen this one before. Gale Sayers seems to sign a lot.
Yeah, right? More than, the value is less than you would think. That's the problem there. He did sign a lot, and his stuff is usually about 300, I think, in the past when we've looked it up. Signed balls or, a jersey might be a little bit more signed. That might raise it. But a ball and just an autograph is usually like 150, 300.
Okay. I would, and they sent a picture, and they've got it like on display with a bunch of other sports memorabilia behind it. But that's the kind of thing that I personally, and I would never get away with this with the wife at home, but this would be in the middle of the coffee table.
Right.
I'd just be like, put the chips around it. This is a signed ball right. in a glass box. Gail Sayers.
Exactly. And that's a lot of people feel that way. So that's why they're disappointed when we give them the bad news on that it's not worth $1,000 or $2,000. So
take a look here. I want to show you what I've got. A Bob Fioretti for state senator.
Nice.
This would be a 2015 jobber.
Yeah, that's
take a look.
It's got a nice t-shirt. Graphic. That's
nice
for
graphic.
Sure. It is.
There's a couple rising stars.
Yeah.
Fifth district state senator.
I'm probably going to say, though, $10 to $12.
Oh, that's yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll take that. Okay.
The hometown record, the Q101 record, might be...
yeah, let's get to that one.
Probably
so $15
to $20.
Really? WKQX hometown album. This is from 1977.
Yep.
This is the blue balloon on the front and the clouds.
It.
You had it.
I had it, sold it. You know, I do buy those if I see them. If I can get them for a dollar or two, I'll buy it to sell it. But... yeah, it's just still a $15 to $20 record. The Loop records do better.
Oh, they do.
They did two. One's the black cover, and the other one is like a newspaper cover. And
okay.
Kevin Lee, who's still performing, is on the first one. So that kind of helps the value of that. It's about a $15 to $20 record there. And the second one, I couldn't tell you who really is on that one.
Right.
But
all right. Well, there you go.
Yep.
So getting some good stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Like I said, I've got a lot of stuff. I've got a pizza. Look at this plate. I want to show you this. This is an old style.
Oh, there you go. Now
pizza
you got
plate. Established 1902. I don't think the plate's that
right,
old, but,
right.
You know, that's the. Yeah. And it also comes with an old style cozy. Is
nice.
That what you call these things?
Koozie. Koozie? And I never know how to spell it when I sell those, either K or C. I don't know. So I usually put both in my search.
Look at that for old style.
But yeah, that old style, that's cool. I would definitely gravitate to that if I saw it, and I'm going to try to get you a price
okay.
on that.
And while we're doing that, take a look at this unopened bottle of Malort, Jepson's Malort.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the background of that, but.
It's a really, really terrible liquor
right.
that is made in Chicago, and it's almost like a Chicago thing to get a shot of Malort.
Okay.
If you've ever had a shot of Malort, it is not good.
And you won't forget it, right?
And I remember we had a great guest on who came through and was super into Malort.
Wow.
And was trying to convince us to become Malort, and they gave us a bottle of this.
Wow.
And I don't think this bottle of Malort is going to make it to 303 for the new building.
It might be a good
thing. I don't know if it's
going to make
it. Because you always have those, you know, the Mad Men kind of thing where they have a bottle of liquor in their drawer and you can pull it out and like, let's have a drink and talk about the new Marlboro campaign.
Yeah, you could do better than
that. We're not doing Malort. Let's have a drink. Let me pour it. That
I'd
would
like
be a funny bit, though, right?
You can do better than that.
That would be a funny bit. Hey, come in for a drink.
Save that for like the guests that you don't like.
So anyway, that's probably an expensive bottle. It's a full bottle, but I don't know what they're going for.
I can't find the plate, of course, so that's good news. I think you could probably start at 25 auction on that, on the old-style pizza plate.
Yes.
So that's good news.
All right. See, I'm killing it here.
Yep.
A lot of...
It's always the stuff you don't think will sell.
A lot of junk. I've got... okay, and I mentioned this one right before you came in. I've got a t-shirt. My brother was moving. He had a whole idea for a new t-shirt collection. Chi-Town is Guy-Town.
Okay, yeah.
And he had made a ton of these, and he was trying to get them to catch on in the gay community. Like, Chi-Town is Guy-Town.
Yeah, no, I think it would do well, still.
It didn't take off, but I've got one of the prototypes.
Oh, if it's a prototype, for sure. I think you could start at 25, and I'm sure it would go up.
According to you, I have probably about $500 plus in tchotchkes in my office.
I'm not doubting that.
And none of it's going to make it out of the trash.
Oh, man. Put it in a box and call me. I'll come pick it up.
312-981-7200 in studio tonight. My man, Greg Flam at DuPage Picker. 708 says he's got a Hank Aaron signed baseball bat.
Okay.
A baseball bat signed
good.
By Hank
good.
Aaron. Now, the question I have, do you get like old Hank Aaron? Like, you know, because he hit that home run that made him the home run champion. He was pretty old at that point, wasn't he? Like there was a whole career before that,
right?
Yeah, those two guys caught up to him when he was running around the bases.
Yeah,
you know,
third. Yeah.
They caught up to him. That's how old he was. He couldn't outrun the two hippies.
I wonder if that's when he signed the bat.
Yeah, he signed it around.
Signed
third.
The bat, or you're not touching home plate. Yeah, no, the bat would be cool, especially if it was signed. You know, like pre-80, it would be worth more than if it was signed later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to guess 350 to start.
Wow.
And definitely do an auction on that.
All right, let's keep going. Let's go to Paul. Paul, what do you want to brag about, Paul?
Yes. My wife, when she passed away a year and a half ago, she has a baseball. She used to date one of the guys, I guess, on the Cincinnati Reds. And she's got Johnny Bench's, supposedly, the last away game signed by him and 30 of the players.
Wow, 30 players.
That's a big red machine.
Yep.
Because I counted 30, but I don't remember the names. I'm driving right now. So. Wow.
Yeah, if again, we've talked about team or multiple signatures on a ball. You have to really make sure they're real because so much was auto-penned. Right. Or, like, four of them will be auto-penned and the rest will be real, but it will just drag down the value because those other four aren't. And many times, as we've talked, one signature can really be worth more than a team signature because of that. But, yeah, I don't think I could put much more than $40 on that, unless you can get all those signatures verified and you'd have to send it out to be graded and authenticated, which that many signatures would be costly.
Yeah. I just wanted to be known that I was part of the baseball bunch and the Johnny Bench baseball bunch.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Or he had the whole thing on the back of the cereal box and I sent in and I got back wristbands, baseball bunch wristbands.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
How much would those be going for?
Oddly, probably close to what
I don't think I have anymore, and they're probably stretched out. But that was
yeah. I think those would still be starting at 15. I'll look them up during the break for sure. But
telling me, man,
did Paul say that his late wife? Did he say I think she dated one of the Cincinnati Reds? Is that what he said?
I think so.
I want to know more about that.
Yeah, right.
And kudos to Paul for
it's specific because that was Johnny Bench's last away game. They said
that's what
so
he said,
you're talking mid-80s. He played into mid-80s, so those probably weren't the greatest Reds teams.
Yeah, plus
like, he's talking about the 1977 Reds. You're like, oh, that's a full Pete Rose is on the Padres by this point.
Yeah,
you know, like Pete Rose is betting on games at this point,
right? And you have to prove that. You have to prove that it was his last road game,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
But anyway, just a Johnny Bench ball to give the guy an idea. It's about $80 just for Johnny Bench's signature only.
Baseball bunch.
Mm-hmm.
312-981-7200. Greg Flamm is here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. If you want to get a hold of him, he's evaluating your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. We'll take a quick break and an update on tonight's news. Get right back at it with Swap Meet. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flamm.
Here we are, second
That's
half.
Right. Second half, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. It's a Swap Meet second half, so let's get it started. Tom, what do you want to brag about, Tom? Kick us off.
I have a Bob Green's original first book about Michael Jordan.
Yep.
And I have it signed by both Bob Green and Michael Jordan.
Ooh, how'd you get both of them? Were they signing it together somewhere?
No, I knew Wayne Larrabee, so he took the book with him and got it signed. And on a Christmas Eve, I went down to the Tribune and got Bob Green to sign it for me.
Very nice.
Is there any better story that starts with, well, you know, I know Wayne Larrabee.
Right. That's a good one.
That's a great story.
And obviously, there's nothing to compare as far as, you know, Jordan and Green signing that book. So you definitely have to do an auction if you do want to sign it. And just to Jordan, I found Jordan signed that book by Bob Green, and they're asking $300.
So
none have sold at that amount, but that's what they're asking just for the Jordan signature. So I would guess you'd be in that ballpark, but start it as an auction.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks,
Todd. Okay. I also have a small earpiece that's white, and on the outside edge of it, it has the Cubs emblem. And it says Cubs, and then underneath it says WGN, and it has an on-off switch. and it only picks up WGN radio.
Oh, yeah, the preset radio is nice. Probably in the $40 range to start. I've had a couple of those before, maybe not that exact one, but I had like the baseball one that was like that and so forth. But yeah, start an auction at $40 and see what happens. Do you know if it still works? Have you tried playing it?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yep.
That's awesome.
Yep. Very cool.
And then adds on a WGN nostalgia piece.
Very nice.
Nice job, Tom.
Yep.
Good job. That might.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. That might have a front runner for Brad. Right. I like the Bernie Upton button, but yep. I also like that. So let's go to Brian. Brian, what do you want to brag about, Brian?
How you doing? Good. I got a 1981 Chicago White Sox plastic coffee mug, and the logo is how the Sox have on their this year's spring training hats. And then on the back of the coffee cup with the White Sox, they got the old style beer logo.
Okay.
Cool. And like you said, I got it 1981. But at the time, I was 11 years old, so I must have had a good giveaway because I would think they wouldn't give alcoholic related to a minor.
Right.
I thought that was kind of, and what happened, we had some water damage in our basement and had a box of coffee cups. Some were Boy Scouts, you know, from when I was in Boy Scouts, and they got donated to the Scouts and everything. And the White Sox mug, I got it up on my bookcase, you know, in my baseball card shrine at the house here and everything. And I was just curious, and I was like looking on eBay and everything else and typing 1981 old style, this and that, White Sox mug, and I couldn't find anything. I know it's not worth $1 million or
nothing. Yeah, there's not sold, but there is one available right now, and they're asking $15 for it. So obviously,
I figured in the $20 range.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever were to sell it, definitely do an auction because there aren't a lot on there, and it's a nice looking mug. I saw a picture of it on
yeah, they are. It is kind of cool, but yeah. I just thought it was, for me, it's like more history. Hey, 11-year-old.
Yeah, I mean,
it's awesome. Yeah,
you're probably better off just keeping it for that price.
Oh, but I do. I just, you know, throw my pens in there or my change or however, and it's just, you know, in my Hall of Fame.
Nice.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Brian.
Thanks for the call.
The reason they gave you the mug is that 11-year-old mustache you were sporting. I mean, a huge
back in the early 80s.
Tell Brian we can call back for the Chicago accent challenge.
Yeah, right.
He's
here.
Got a,
nice, there you go. Yeah, nice, he does. Accent. You're right. That's tomorrow night. It's Ed McClellan. So, Brian, call back in. We'll get your Portillo's order. 270 says a Louisville bat bench with three bases for seats made in the mid 70s by Louisville Sluggers for Sporting Goods Store. Bats were with Ernie Banks, Johnny Bench, Roberto Clemente.
Wow.
And others near mint condition. I don't even know what that means. What am I reading?
I'm assuming it's a bench made on the plate, but I don't understand three. He mentioned three plates, right?
It's three bases for seats.
Three bases, yeah. Oh, okay, I see. For the
Ernie,
back,
so the bats
were
like
back, the seat, and then probably underneath the seat they used those
bats.
And then the bats are probably the arms and legs. That's really unique, and I've seen other teams do that. So you know that. With those bats, if they're actually signed by those people or if they're just their bats, that makes a difference. And I'm saying that's usually something that's like at a corporate auction type thing. And it could go for, you know, 1,000 or 5,000, depending what, you know, people bid for them at those auctions.
Right.
But in general, on eBay, I'd say it's probably like a $700 to start auction on eBay. But on like I said, it's usually a corporate auction, silent auction thing they do.
Right. 312-981-7200. Got a Gordie Howe signed National League Baseball.
Yeah, that is.
It's interesting. Gordie Howe played hockey.
Mm-hmm. Right. His signature is in the 300 range. So on a baseball, I'm not sure if that would add or subtract. You know, it is rare that it's on a baseball, so that hopefully would add to it. But just his signature on a hockey puck or stick is about 300.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that's pretty cool, I guess.
Now I feel like we should do a whole segment on what Gordie Howe signed.
Oh, there's a lot. There's so much.
A lot different. 224 says, with all this talk about Korea these days, I have an original political cartoon dated Friday, November 3rd, 1950.
Okay.
That was drawn for the Chicago Tribune. It measures 18 inches tall and 15 inches wide. And the top is an inscription that says, "And he still wants in the club." And it's a... Yes, he sent a picture of it. It's interesting. Like, wow. It's a Korean soldier or Chinese soldier with the UN flag tattered on the back of a bayonet. It looks, wow. And it's an editorial of the time. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm punching at some of those keywords to see, but yeah, it's...
That's awesome. It's so true. I mean, you look at it, you're like, yeah, you can talk about like what you can't get away with. You can't do that. I mean, they have a Red China soldier, and it's not as egregious as some of the other stuff you've seen of caricatures, of Asian right. caricatures, but it's definitely in that family.
Yeah. There
you go.
I couldn't find it, so obviously that makes it a little bit more rare.
I like
so
it.
Should be good.
That's a good one. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll get our last calls and texts in. You still got a chance to win this pizza and find out what your junk is worth. 312-981-7200 is the swap meet. Stay with us. It's a swap meet, 312-981-7200 at 720 WGN, and I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flamm is here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We're going through a ton of stuff tonight, evaluating your collectibles, seeing what it's worth, your memorabilia, even your junk.
Yep.
And Greg has already taken off my hands probably 15 items from our office.
I want the rest of it, though.
Here's more. We'll go back there. We'll go back. You can see. All right. 847 says, I have an autographed hardcover copy of Grinding It Out by Ray Kroc.
That is nice. And I'm a McDonald's guy, 6 years in. So.
Oh, there you go.
Unsigned, you can get the books for like $4. And I could not find any sold that were signed, but I did find about three asking prices for signed, and they're asking $900 to $1,000 for it. But I don't know if they're going to get that. So, you have to just do probably $900 or best offer and just.
Did you say $900?
That's what there's three of them on there, and that's what they're asking, $900 to $1,000.
You're a McDonald's guy,
right.
6 years in.
Yep.
Is a autograph of Ray Kroc worth $900 when you tell me Johnny Benjamin is $15?
Right. No, I don't think so, to be honest, as much as I'd like to tell the person it's worth that. But honestly, I don't think it's worth more than $150, maybe.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But we'll see. I mean, good luck. Hopefully, they'll get their price on this.
Okay. There you go. Let's see. I got more here. A baseball signed on the Sweet Spot, 6-3-0. They like that tonight. Signed on the Sweet Spot by Rod Blagojevich.
Oh, wow.
Nice. That's so Blagojevich, too. He's probably walking through a parade and just grabs some kid's ball. Yeah. No one asked him. He's like, let me sign this for you.
He's probably standing next to a baseball player.
Let me just go ahead and sign this up for you. Yep. Yeah. Don't forget to vote in November.
Yep.
Not guilty.
That's nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's Rod Blagojevich stuff. We haven't really had too much of that. Is Rod Blagojevich
I'm going to think his election stuff is probably worth more than the other items, his election posters and so forth, because that's the stuff that's happening to him now. But I would say hold on to that stuff, too, though. But the baseball, I don't know. I mean, you can see what happens, but it's...
All right. Let's see. 708 says he's got a Walter Payton signed Super Bowl 20 football.
Mm-hmm.
And you think Walter would be like, no way. For all the historical accounts of how much he hated that game.
Yeah.
You think he'd be like, I ain't signing anything.
And only one sold, and it was in the $100 range. There's quite a few of them out there to get. So just so you know what they are going for, I guess. 100.
100.
But I think, other Peyton stuff like jerseys go for more than that. So again, it's because people do know that he wasn't fond of that.
Maybe. Like, it's like, but I would think like Richard Dent being the MVP of that game.
Yeah.
If he did the same thing, if he signed a football, Richard Dent,
right.
Would it be the same as a Walter Peyton signature?
I'd like to think it'd be a little bit more because he was MVP. But Richard does a lot of corporate stuff from what I hear, so he's signing a lot of stuff.
Is he?
So, yeah. So,
all right, let me rephrase. Let me
come up.
What
with,
was it? Reggie Phillips.
Yeah.
Remember Reggie Phillips?
Otis Wilson or something. Yeah. Reggie,
Phillips was the backup corner. Was it Reggie Phillips?
48.
Yeah, number 48, who came in for Leslie Frazier, who had busted his knee on the idiot reverse. They tried to reverse, remember
right.
that? That's how he busted his knee, and he was pretty much done for his career.
Mm-hmm.
Reggie Phillips came in as the backup, never really got much playing time with the team all season long, and he got an intercept pick six in that game.
Nice.
What's that worth?
If it's that ball, if you save that ball and you can authenticate it, it maybe $1,000 for that exact ball. But right. A Reggie ball just by itself, no.
I love I'm getting down. Tyrone Keyes. Talk about a Tyrone. I'm just going to go through all the we'll go 80s
obscure,
beers.
Right.
All right.
Obscure beers obscure for 100. Beers.
How about a Durand lamp? Mm-hmm. I guess this is a lamp. It's like a Durand lamp that was bought at a garage sale for $2. That's what 630 says. They sent a picture of a Durand lamp. What is that?
That's a designer lamp, and I couldn't find that exact design, but some of the other designs by that artist or company go for $1,000 to $2,000. So that's pretty cool for a $2 find. You should easily, you know, if you were to sell it, make some good money on it. Especially since I couldn't find one, too. That makes it, you know, harder to find, so someone might pay up for that.
Okay, well, there you go. That's a lamp.
Mm-hmm.
Better than $2.
Much more, yeah.
All right, let's see. One more here. A 1953 Cubs yearbook in good condition.
Yeah, that's something kind of like a baseball card. The condition's everything, because I've seen them go for $25 and also upwards of $100. So condition's everything, dog-eared corners, creases, stuff like that. You're just going
to
make sure.
What I like to call the Justin Kaufman condition.
Right.
There's not one thing that I own. Everything that you've told me, oh, yeah, this is good. I'm like, oh, how about, oh, well, I got it, and it's folded.
Yeah,
I folded it.
Popcorn stain on it, you know. And
Pete told me he folds all his food. That's what he just said yesterday, so I'm sure he did the same to his posters. A lot of folded posters.
Nice.
With the duct tape on the back, and you're like, I'm not going to remove it. I'll just roll it, and it gets stuck, you know, and you're like, what did I do here?
Yeah, I don't know why, like, the teams give out posters, you know, because they never make it home, you know?
No.
I think they should let you get it on the way out. Okay, you're on your way out. You can take it that way, you know? So.
No, they are long gone.
Yeah.
By the time you're done with the game, there's nobody in that stadium. It's the Wild Wild West.
Well, they can, you know, kind of like the hat trick. Don't they let you go back and get your hat out of like a big pile of hats after a hat trick?
I
thought they let you go back and try to pick out your hat.
I did not know that. I thought that was pure commitment to the game of hockey, right? That you would throw your hat on to show the how much you enjoyed this performance from this hockey player. I'm going to lose my hat.
Yeah.
What's next? Are they gonna? You can get your catfish back.
I can't remember.
In Nashville or your octopus?
Right. Yeah.
What do you got? You're coming up Wolf's Flea Market coming up here
every Saturday and Sunday. I'm indoors at Palatine, but I do go to Rosemont for a couple hours before Sunday.
And we got to go out there and
you do
something
you really
live.
Do.
We got to do something where we can tape a couple shows, maybe put up a podcast, but do something where we're in that community.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
So fun.
Yeah, it is. Last weekend, I heard they had close to 700 vendors, like 652 vendors. Yeah.
All right, we got to make that happen. This is the summer to do it.
Yep.
The summer of wolves. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, joins us every Wednesday, except for the next 2 weeks, which you will be on Thursdays. As we switch around the White Sox games.
Mm-hmm.
But Greg Flam and the Swap Meet can be heard here on 720 WGN. Greg, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you. Thanks.